We see here then in verse 13 that the second beast doeth great wonders. He makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. Verse 14. And deceiveth them. Please notice that. And deceiveth them. A lot of people think today because someone does a sign or a wonder or a miracle, that's a man of God. Don't you believe it? It says he deceives them by means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. So we see that the second man, the religious man, is more dangerous than the first man, the political man. Be very careful of anything miraculous in these days. Make sure it comes from God. People tell me they have dreams and they have visions and they prophesy. I say, praise God, because that's a sign of the book of Joel. In the last days, you'll have dreams and visions and prophecies, but they must fit in with the word of God. Otherwise, we'll be deceived. Do you realize that you can have a vision through eating too much fruitcake at night? You make sure it fits in with the word of God.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 10th of March 2023. Streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Show app. Available free from all good app stores. Anything but Google, please. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives. Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity vanished in the Ukraine psyop, turning a blind eye to the failings of coke-snorting Zio-Nazi hero Zelensky and the masochistic Russian sanctions. An unhappy bunch of Goldman Sachs Bilderberg Nazi death trip deep state losers. On a hiding to nothing, waging, in fact, war on the British people now, as well as Putin, what the BBC might sound like if it were free of the tentacles of the deep state and the Zionist lobbies. So, navigating us through the fourth Mike Matrix or the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution this week is not Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. I've put him on gardening leave. No, he's in transit running some errands, family errands and things. So we're joined instead by John Langley, former candidate for mayor of Bristol. In part one this week, we're going to have a look at Matt Hancock from the point of view of the doctor that uncovered the murder of Dr. David Kelly, that is to say Dr. David Halpin, his view on Matt Hancock and the masks, etc. Save Bristol Zoo Gardens. We've got a march here going on in Bristol here on Sunday. We hear from the former mayor George Ferguson about what that's all about and why it is that Bristol Zoo is being bulldozed, apparently to make way for a few luxury flats. And also we hear from Zeke Bond. Now, his daughter was arrested in the Kill the Bill protests. In part two, an investigation into the wild camping business down in Dartmoor. This hedge fund manager who moved in and then promptly tried to change the law to stop anyone wild camping on Dartmoor. We talked to Ian Spence. He's the father of Jasmine, who we heard from a couple of weeks ago in Oxford, talking about the accelerationists. Well, she called them the greedy people, and she said, unless you deal with them, don't bother focusing on individual crises. Understand that there is a bunch out there who are creating as many crises as they can. By whatever crisis is around, they come up with a solution that will make it even worse. So we'll have Ian Spence a bit later too. Also, Willful Blindness, there's a book on that. Andrew Bridgen talked about it before Christmas. But what is it? There's a whole study of this whole area of humanity where we turn a blind eye in order to keep our job to the obvious. Another aspect from the organophosphate story from Mark Purdy, this organic farmer who died, but I interviewed him back in 2002, roughly back then. He's fascinating things to say about the whole BSE scandal and what really caused that. And we have David Livingstone, the author David Livingstone, author of Auto Ab Chao, also author of a fantastic book, which is really important to understand what's going on today. That's Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea. He's talking about Alexander Dugin, who's been speaking out in Russia this week and saying, talking about the Nazis in Ukraine. But apparently, according to David, he's just playing a game over there. But also we hear from David about what he makes of King Charles. And finally, a look at the UN religion. So, yeah, Martin Summers free zone, but it's not a guest free zone at all, because we've got John Langley here, who stood for mayor of Bristol a few years ago. John, why did you decide you wanted to stand for mayor?
Yeah, with all that content, I'll be in and out of here within 30 seconds. thank you for inviting me back. You're very kind. Most people don't. what made me stand for mayor? Well, that's a question I'm still asking myself, and my psychiatrist keeps asking me. No, I'm joking. I stood for mayor because I believed Bristol needed a change, and it needed more sensible politics that weren't party political driven.
One of the headlines when you stood was that you'd been a former pornography star.
Oh, God, yeah. Didn't that get me publicity? You know, I got millions of subscribers overnight on the basis of that. So, you know, every cloud, as they say.
And one of the reasons I wanted you to come along, John, is because you're just in the process of publishing your, well, it's effectively an autobiography.
It's out now. It's on. What is it on? Remind me. It's on Amazon.
Oh dear, not Amazon. Oh well. Okay.
Someone had to.
Yeah. What's the title of the autobiography?
It is called The Sexual Philanthropist.
Right. As you said, a bit of clickbait there.
It is clickbait. Exactly. Clickbait,
but I mean, you've been through your ups and downs over the years, haven't you?
Yeah,
so can you tell us first of all, you know, what were you up to before the world of porn?
I would guess, what one might describe to be a peripatetic lifestyle. So I left home. It's like you're shrugging your shoulders, like you never heard of the word. We can Google it quickly for you. But, no, I just
traveled. It means a wanderer.
Thank you, yes. It meant I was a wanderer. So I joined the army. The army threw me out.
How long were you in the army for?
About 6 weeks.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, and they were marvellous. I mean,
did you even get a chance to for them to decide which part of the army you were going to be in?
I mean, yeah, the Royal Army Medical Corps.
Right, oh, okay. And why did they throw you out?
What happened was the captain called me into the office one day and said, would you really like to serve your queen and country? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, the best thing you could do would be to leave then. And so they were very accommodating. And you know,
why?
They packed my bags and even took them to the gates for me and even ordered me a taxi.
Did your face not fit or what?
I was too boisterous, I would say. You know,
disobedient.
Well, that's another word for it, yeah. I wouldn't take no for an answer. And it was the sort of thing where if somebody barks an order at me, I'll say, well, excuse me, do you know the word, please? You know, and that doesn't tend to go down very well.
Well, it doesn't really
army.
Work in a war situation, does
no, it?
It
doesn't.
You know, because you do need to have a kind of very strict hierarchy. So
yeah.
Otherwise, you know, the army can't really fight, can it? It's pulling itself in all sorts of different directions, especially when it comes to medical matters. You want to make sure that you've got an efficient way of saving people's lives.
But I was brought up to have manners.
Yeah, well, I don't think that really works in the army, does it? Nor that I've ever been in the army, but no, in the armed forces generally, I mean, there is a time for manners and there's a time to get on and knuckle down. So the army, you came out of the army?
Had about 36 different jobs in 18 months.
What part of the country?
In London.
Yeah.
Yeah. And couldn't settle at anything. I just couldn't settle at anything.
So was this 1980s, 70s, what?
Late 70s, okay. Early 80s.
Yeah. This was quite a good time in London, actually, wasn't it? I mean, it must have been quite a nice... You know, people were paid reasonably well. I mean, how did you get on?
I ducked and dived here and there.
Survived.
You know, if you've kind of read any of the books so far... you'll find that I was kind of mixed up with the underworld of Soho at that time.
Mm-hmm.
At arm's length, I have to say.
But you gravitated towards Soho, did you?
Yeah, because it was everything my Roman Catholic upbringing wasn't. It was fascinating to me. You know, there was all these strip clubs and girls hanging outside of doors inviting you in, and it's like, whoa, what is this? So it was diametrically opposed to my upbringing. And therefore, it became of great fascination to me. And I got to know lots of people, and some of which, say, were underworld. And it was just a fascinating place. You know, you could go into a cafe and you could be talking to a stripper, or you could be talking to a tourist. It could be anybody, and just listen to conversations and get involved with people, engage with people. And they were very, very down-to-earth people. And it was just a fantastic place to be.
One of the things that you say in the book is that you really loved the idea of just hanging out in cafes, really.
Yeah.
And people coming in, new people, you'd chat to them for 5 minutes, you'd never see them again.
Yeah.
But it was a whole kind of learning.
It was.
Everyone was sharing the real dope, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, exactly. It was a fascinating place to be. And even to this day, you can find me sitting outside cafes looking at the world go by. You know, even when I wrote this book, a lot of inspiration comes from just sitting and observing and then letting that ideas build up and creativity, which you then sort of put it, which I then put into words. And it just helped to bring back memories. And I'd look at people and I'd say, oh, you remind me of somebody. And then I'd make notes and I'd go back and think, yeah, that's who it was. So even to this day, I'm still in and out of cafes.
Sound like you're a kind of observer of life.
Yes.
Loves doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I mean, all this allure of the pornographic world, the sex world, the strip clubs, all that sort of thing, I mean, it's not quite what it seems on the outside, is it?
No. It's full of scammers and all kinds of... Well, it was in those days. You know, I remember... in certain, you know, what they call the clip joints and places like that.
So what was a clip joint?
Oh, a clip joint is where you would go and pay extortionate amounts of money for a bottle of champagne and just a rip-off, basically. And the girls would sit there quietly thinking that, or were leading the customer to believe that they were drinking alcohol when really it was just a glass of water and they were putting it in the nearest plant pot.
So it's kind of escort girl style. You're just to be with someone attractive and you're paying extra money.
Yeah.
And they will share conversation with you, that sort of thing.
And the best one, whereas you'd have a guy and a girl at the top of the stairs and they go, right, come in and see the show, come in and see the show. And they'd be selling tickets. And then whoever bought the ticket would go down the back of the stairs and find themselves in a car park. By which time, they came back up the stairs, they were gone. They were gone off to the next one. You know, it was full of rackets and it was just fascinating. It was a script in itself. It really was.
Yeah. And did you end up, how did you get, I mean, it's one thing taking an interest in this part of London.
Yeah.
It's a whole other thing taking your clothes off and being filmed.
Yeah. Well, I escalated, I suppose you could call it escalated, over a number of years. Now, that was actually quite interesting, because when video cameras first came out, they were these huge, great things like you see television crews with, and they cost about, £2,500. They were hideously expensive. So only the wealthy people, or the people who had more disposable income could actually buy these cameras. And at the time, there was something called the amateur photographer, which I'm sure, one or two of your listeners may well be familiar with. And the back pages were full of classified advertising. And at that time, you could only really buy sort of the adult tapes in sex shops, and they were very much under the counter. And some of these tapes would cost £80, £90, £100 each, because they were smuggled in from places like Sweden. So when these cameras came out, I saw an opportunity and thought, we could be making money out of this. And so with all...
So this is your Catholic entrepreneur.
This is my this is my Catholic education. Exactly. It taught me well. So I saw the opportunity for all these guys who wanted to suddenly become porn movie directors. And we advertised in the back of this photographic magazine. And I got myself a girl partner as well. And we were... Back in the 80s, we were charging £75 an hour. And the whole thing was scripted. So half of them didn't even know how the camera worked, but they'd come in and we'd basically direct the whole thing, say, right, this is where we're going to start, this is what we're going to do, this is where it's going to end, that's it.
So you're paying £75 an hour?
No, I was being paid £75 an hour. And the girl I was working with, she was being paid.
So who did you charge? Who was paying the bill?
The guy with the camera? The guy with the camera.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody could afford, £2,000 for a camera, they could afford £150. Simple as that. And so that's how it began. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually been to a TV station years ago where they were doing this kind of thing with girls sitting on a bed kind of chatting to the camera, all extremely seedy, where people people have to pay money to go and see this. I mean, this whole pornographic world actually is, I mean, it's morally, you know, it's a temptation for many men, particularly single men, actually for married men as well, sometimes aren't happy in their relationships. Yeah. But is it actually corrosive? Surely the whole thing is corrosive on the soul.
For some people it will be. I think it's an incredibly empowering position for women.
Well, many women would say that, in fact, most of the pornographic world, should we say, including prostitution, many of the women are actually heroin addicts, and they're reliant on the pimps for their heroin. And they're completely entrapped in that
more
situation.
More so nowadays, but I'm very much for the empowerment of women. And if a woman can use her body to make money, it's an asset, and she is able to do that. And, you know, not everyone is on drugs. If they're able to do that and they feel empowered by it, they feel sexually empowered by it, financially empowered by it, then I would support it all day long.
Yeah, but the thing is, this is a couple of old blokes talking about, you know, women, oh, it's a liberating thing. No, it's not.
You speak for yourself.
It's not. Well, I am speaking for myself. It's not, surely. I mean, it's actually a form of just pure financial exploitation, you know. You stand there and do something. You're a prostitute. You're just being paid a paid monkey to go and do something. It doesn't matter what it is. And there's no moral aspect to it at all. It's just money for old rope.
And who are the mugs? The men who pay it. They're the ones who are exploited, really. You know, I mean, I've known girls that do webcam to earn £600 a night doing webcam. I've known escorts, excuse me, who've earned, in fact, I filmed one. She earned £3,200 in 1 week. You know, you wouldn't earn that kind of money elsewhere. Now, what she actually did, and a lot of the girls are very, very clever, she was Romanian. She had set her sights on making £250,000 to go back to Romania and open a beauty salon. And at the end of 2 years, she had enough money to go back and actually do that. And she was 19 years old, and she would never have to go back to doing any sex work again in her life.
I mean, wouldn't it be nice if a Romanian could just open a beauty salon without having to come to London and sell their body for 2 years?
Sure. In the perfect world, it would be, but this isn't the perfect world.
No, it certainly isn't.
It never will be.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say, don't bet on that. I think, you know, there are some things are getting worse, some things are getting better. But certainly, you know, the you must have seen in your lifetime quite a lot of changes in the acceptance and the morality of porn.
Yeah, yeah, a great deal. A lot of things that would have been taboo many, many years ago have now become more accepted. A lot more people are open to... I mean, look, I had up to 10 million viewers, fans, followers, supporters... so it just goes to show the demand for it. Now, what is worrying, and I think what we should be concerned about, moreover, is now that AI is coming in, it's making people redundant from that industry. Because, as a for instance, let us say you could you decide that you want the body of one actress and the face of another, and have sex with her all day long. Right, that's the way it's going. Having said that, what's even more worrying, and I think it's something that we should all be worried about, is that you could do exactly the same thing with children. It's AI. It's out there. You could have a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old, do whatever you like with them, and there's nothing that anybody can do about it because it's AI, it is fantasy, it is, you are not...
Well, they have these things called love robots, don't they?
Yeah.
Which are, yes. I think, isn't it, the Japanese have become particularly big on.
This is worrying.
It's straying into the area, and it's bound to. And I wonder if you ever saw this in London, in Soho, straying into the area of child pornography.
Yeah, I've never seen child pornography, thankfully. I've never wanted to.
But, I mean, the temptation amongst these underground people, surely, is to go for ever younger girls.
There's younger and there's younger. I think if anybody is 18, then it's acceptable. I think anything... In fact, I think the whole... This ridiculous idea about, you know, you can get a driving license at 17, you can't buy fags till you're 25, you can have sex at 16. For God, it's just absolutely ridiculous. One age, 18, 21 for the lot, absolutely fine. Everyone knows where they stand. But as far as anything younger... then that's an absolute no-no, and as I said...
I mean, there's at the far end of the world you're involved in is the Jimmy Savills, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the higher you are in power, the more corruption there is and the more likelihood there is for such things like the Jimmy Savile.
Did you see, did you know anything about Savile when you were in London? No. Was it completely news to you when it all broke?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't for me. I mean, I'd been told rumours about him. You know, I've also been told rumours about Cliff Richard.
Yeah.
And so you're never quite sure until these sort of things come out. And obviously it is kept away from the public. It's kept away from many journalists. Although, of course, there is also this rather frightening idea that many journalists know things that they're just simply not allowed to write about, not even in opinion pieces.
That's right. Yeah, I know.
So the world stays quite... Yeah. So what did you make of it when it all came out? What did you think? I mean, this establishment paedophile, one of the most famous people in the country, all over the BBC, on the radio, and on Jim Will Fix It, and suddenly, he's doing a programme where he has these little kids sitting on his knee, but he is the biggest paedophile Britain has ever seen.
Yeah, and he was well protected by the establishment. And I, you know, the reason I think behind it is that there were too many other names involved. It's, you know, and I think you could pretty much say the same thing about the Prince Andrew Epstein story nowadays. I think there's a whole lot more to come out of it that hasn't been said so far. I think...
Well, a lot of it is in Whitney Webb's book.
Yeah, Maxwell
One
has,
Nation Under Blackmail, if anyone's interested in the whole network in the States, particularly around that, where the idea was... back in the Second World War, the underworld in the States was mobilised to fight Hitler. After the war, that group still kept going, and they realised that, oh, well, we can use this for blackmail.
Yeah, and I think Ghislaine Maxwell knows a lot more than she's saying as well. And that may come to light at some point. But for now, it just, you know, it's just there in the air, and there will... I think there's a point where every truth comes to light, and her day will come.
So what about the other end of the spectrum then? Because, what about this basic idea that sex is actually something sacred that should only take place within marriage, the idea that it's taking place here, there and everywhere is creating all these, you know, potentially unwanted children.
Yeah, I know. Have you seen the piece in the book that I've read? No. I'm just said that, sex is great. And I do think half the problem now is that the world is becoming overpopulated because it's seen as a sort of biblical done thing where men and women get together and they have to have children, and I don't think it's necessary. There's
more abortion than there's ever been in history.
And there's also a big fight back from some couples who don't think the world is a safer place now to have children. So that's moving along as well. But if I was had my time again, I certainly would not be having children now. I don't think it's the right place for children at all.
Well, that's a world that's changed, isn't it? I mean, when we were growing up, it was lots and lots of positivity. I was over in Moscow back in 2015, and I looked around the streets of Moscow and saw the same sort of positivity that was in London in the 60s and 70s, which was, you know, we think the future's ours. Yeah, a lot of the young people felt the future's ours. Yeah. And now, I think for a lot of young people, they're looking at the adult population and say, what kind of world have you left us?
Exactly, yeah. I agree. I agree, and I've gone into it in detail in the book and said the world is overpopulated, and do we really need to be having more children when the resources are getting less? and I don't think it's a viable thing to have children.
Well,
I
mean, there's a lot of people now talking about depopulation, so you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, people have to make their own choices. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong to have children, and people, you know, if they feel they want to have children,
people have surely always made their own choices about having kids.
Yeah,
and if you look at the statistics around the world, you'll find the poorer countries that have the most children.
Yeah.
So poverty is actually fueling a booming population. But I certainly take issue with you as to whether there really is any real overpopulation. Yeah. Surely the problem is with distribution of wealth, resources, food, all that stuff. It's being hoarded.
Agreed.
It's being hoarded.
Agreed.
I mean, look at this business with eggs at the moment. It's a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
The farmers are saying, well, the supermarkets won't pay proper prices for them.
Yeah.
And so, because, I mean, basically, it's the supermarket cartels getting together.
Yeah.
Doing price fixing, and that means that you can only get eggs from the small shops, farm shops, and things like that. But they're trying to, you know, the big players in the world of food are very good now because there are so few of them are actually fixing prices. And this is one of the reasons people are hungry, because surely because the market is being fixed.
Yeah, and capitalization has a lot to do with it. There's a big power challenge between the haves and the have-nots, where the Western world is all about money and capitalism and all the rest of it, and the other side of the world, which is poverty stricken, has nothing. There is absolutely no balance whatsoever.
It's like a chasm, I think. I mean, certainly the way I see it, it's a chasm opening between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
Which is something we were always brought up to abhor, you know, in my youth. This is all wrong. You can't do this. The whole point of the government is to try and make sure that at least there's a reasonable amount of redistribution of wealth. But at the moment, there seems to be the opposite.
No, there's a lot of hoarding of wealth. And that is a major problem and will continue to be a major problem as long as people allow it to be.
Well, you've had your ups and downs, most definitely. Not just on the screen.
Yeah.
You've also ended up homeless for a while, didn't you? Can you just tell us how that happened and take us through how you survived that, how you coped with that, what it was like?
I became voluntarily homeless because of, as I say, my insistence on leading a peripatetic lifestyle. And so I took myself around the country to various places. And it was, for me, it was very much an adventure. I kind of enjoyed being able to go from place to place and to meet new people. And so, my life then was very much about, I always wanted to learn new things. I always wanted to learn about new people. I would learn how things worked. And so by taking myself around the country, it gave me the opportunity to do that. So I became voluntary homeless rather than an involuntary homeless. And it took me everywhere from London to Manchester to Liverpool to Scotland.
How are you paying your way? How are you sleeping? How are you eating?
I was scraping by in whichever way I could. I never begged for money. I always managed to find money. I don't know, it was one of those things where life looked kindly upon me, and I always had access to money. It wasn't never a lot, because when you're living homeless, I didn't need a lot to survive.
So, I mean, where were you getting your money from? Were you doing little odd jobs?
I was dishwashing in certain... Right, if you want to eat, you dishwash in restaurants, you know. If you want to I would buy and sell stuff, so like on the streets and things if you wanted to travel anywhere. Or else, like, in the old days, you could thumb a lift and you'd feel relatively safe. So I always got around, and I had benefits that were coming in as well when the social security people at the time actually recognized I lived, because at one time I went in and said, "Hi, this is me," and they looked me up and said, "Well, you don't exist." And I said, "Well, yes, I do." So I got through that. So I kind of lived on the kindness of other people.
And the dole.
And a little bit of the dole here and there, yeah.
What about drugs? Were you near that world? You surely must have been in the London and in Soho. Drugs are always around.
I wasn't within the homeless scene because the favoured, if you like, drug... I use the term loosely, and the homeless scene was alcohol. That was the drug there. so I'd always been around pot. I'd always been around weed, and I imbibed a little myself, and I sold it here and there in order to keep myself going. And it was a very, the pot world was a very different world then. It was, you know, black, and it was red seal, and it was gold seal, and it was all compressed. It wasn't polluted like it now, like the hybrid stuff nowadays.
We've got this kind of skunk world that appeared in the sort of, was it the late 90s or something like that?
And mostly that came from,
genetically modified?
Genetically modified, mostly by the Sensi Seed Bank in Amsterdam. They were really the sort of pioneers behind it, as far as I'm aware. And it just grew into this hybrid stuff, which was... And I have a problem with it, because it's all about commercialization. In the old days, when you had a little lump of, you know, hash, it was pure... And you got on with people, and you sat around, and you had philosophical conversations, and everyone got on. And it wasn't about getting off your face. It was just about chilling and mellowing. And then the hybrid stuff came in, and it changed the face of the pot, the weed industry completely. And now you've got people going off their face, and it's just wrong. And it's about the money nowadays, and weed... or hash in those days was never, ever, ever about the money. It was about the pleasure, the enjoyment of sharing and the experience.
Mm. Like many things, seems to have been sort of denuded over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of commercialised or...
Yes.
The fun taken out of it, maybe?
Exactly. Exactly.
So how come you've ended up in Bristol?
Well, I was actually in Taunton before I came here. And I needed to be... back in civilization again. So Taunton's a kind of, it's a nice little place, and you know, and it's great if you like cider, and it's nice to drive through, and it's nice if you like ticket. But Taunton's a kind of, like some other places around the country, Taunton's a kind of place where if it could look itself in the mirror, it would become best friends with a Samaritan's hotline. So I decided to leave Taunton and come to Bristol because I like city life. Mm. And that's how I ended up here.
So just getting back to, you know, this whole business of being homeless, were you sleeping in shop doorways? Where were you sleeping?
Oh, God. Where didn't I sleep? I slept in a phone box once. That was interesting. Park benches... mostly night shelters, and where I could get a tent, then I would be out and about and sleeping out and about.
How did you get on with the street people out there?
In those days, they were lovely. They were gentlemen of the road. They weren't like the people you see
nowadays. So you were talking
nowadays.
About, when you're talking about 1980s?
Yeah, 1980s into 1990s.
Right.
They were guys who just liked myself, just like travelling around the country from place to place. You could sit down and they had real life stories that they wanted to talk about. And they were really interesting people. I mean, they liked the Jake, you know, the booze as well. But for the most part, they weren't violent, they weren't aggressive, they weren't challenging in any way at all. They were just generally nice people, and I would hear great stories. And you know, on occasion, sadly, I'd be speaking to someone and saying goodnight to them. In the morning, I'd wake up and they'd be dead beside me. And some of the times were quite tragic in that way. But life on the road, as it is now, is very different to what it was then.
Why?
Drugs, I would say, play a greater part nowadays. Things like spice, which weren't around in those days. All the other drugs which are available. I mean, people on the road then weren't on heroin, and they weren't on cocaine and other stuff. So it's the availability of drugs now makes it very difficult for people. And I can understand if you're living Groundhog Day all the time, you need something to sort of take the pain away from the lifestyle that you're living. And so it would be very easy to slip into the drug routine. But it, again, it's just how society's changed over the years and how much more pressure is on younger people. Well, not necessarily even younger people nowadays, because there are all kinds out there.
Well, look, the book's called The Sexual Philanthropist. In what way are you a philanthropist?
I was sexually very philanthropic.
What do you mean by that?
Everything I did was for nothing, because none of it was about making money. None of it at all.
Did you manage to make any money?
No, not really. Nothing to spend. Do you know, it used to make me laugh when the press used to call me a porn baron. And I had this guy come down from Northampton once. Oh, yeah, Johnny, I've got to get to know you. And I'm sure he lived in a mansion. He thought I lived in a mansion, had a Bentley. And when he came down and saw I lived in a two-bedroom maisonette in Brislington, it was such a shock to him, because he expected this porn baron, and I wasn't interested in that. I just did it for the hell of it. I did it for the challenge, not for the money. And the fact that the internet was you see, people, I think, generally believe that it's all about the sex. Now, sex was secondary to me. It was all about getting on the internet. It was all about building the audience. It was all about the marketing, the advertising, the editing, all the stuff behind the scenes that make it happen. That's what it was about. That was the interesting part. Sex was actually the boring part.
So did you ever build and keep a relationship with a woman? Or?
Oh, I've had, yeah, I've had some. Yeah, absolutely. Not so much back then, but in more recent years, in the last sort of 4 to 5 years, I've had some brilliant relationships with women, which you can read about in the book. But yeah, I've had some brilliant relationships.
What about, okay, just finishing on the book now. Yeah. Have you got an anecdote you can tell us from the book, which just gives us an idea of some of the range of your experiences over the years? Something which really stands out in your mind as, wow, that was a bit of a lesson there.
Everything has been a lesson. I couldn't single out one.
Come on, this is what I'm trying to press you to do. That just take us through. I mean, you're talking about waking up next door to someone next to someone who's just died.
Yeah.
Now we don't do that every day.
No.
And you were working in a very interesting seedy world in Soho. So
yeah.
you must have an anecdote you can tell us from the book.
Have you read about Keith? You didn't get as far. Keith was a bit of a pothead in Liverpool, and we were out one day and we met this guy called Norman, and got chatting to him and sat on the bench, and I looked across and Norman, is this guy Norman's like, and I said to Keith, I said, I think he's dead, you see. So what are we going to do? And he looked at me and said, well, look, I said, we've got to get him to hospital. He said, well, I can go and get a shopping trolley. I said, we can't wheel this guy's dead body through the streets to the hospital on a shopping trolley. So I said, look, we've got to find a way of getting this guy to the hospital, and just leaving him at the hospital to let the nurses and the medical staff deal with him, you know, so that he can just carry on dead in peace. So Keith, being the brilliant kind of idealist that he was on pot, decided it would be a good idea to sort of go and have a look around. And by this time, Norman's head had slumped forward, because obviously, you know, he'd gone. It's finished. So Keith came back with a collar, a medical collar. I said, where'd you get that from? He said, oh, it was some kid down the end of the park. He said, I, you know, gave him some weed and a tenner and got the... And I said, oh, my God, you're joking. Please don't do this. So in the end, we got poor old Norman back to the hospital in Liverpool with a pair of sunnies on, this collar, and left him outside of the hospital to pass on in peace and be cared for and looked after.
Wow, life in the raw, fascinating stuff. Anyway, so yeah, the book is The Sexual Philanthropist, just out, from John Langley, who also stood as mayor of Bristol. Someone, John, that stood against you and won. I believe, was George Ferguson.
Oh, Georgie, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. He was the first independent mayor of Bristol. But anyway, let's let him speak for himself, because we've got all sorts going on. We've had all sorts of controversy this week, because some of the big planning applications that have been slated to be signed off by Marvellous Marvin the Mayor, the so-called Labour Mayor of Bristol, that seems to actually just simply work for land speculators and anything else, you know, for example, having a debate about fair rents and then putting up the rents of the people in the harbour who live in the harbour up by between 200 and 300%.
Now, I mean, he's the guy that Colston's statue came down and Marvin's statue is going to go up. Is that right?
I don't know about that. Well, I certainly hope not, because, he's blighting the city as mayor, I'd say, he's basically taken all the brakes off of planning. So all the city centre land, the big developers are going, well, crikey, look, we've got no kind of real planning going on in Bristol now, so we can get planning permission to build multi-storey office blocks. But anyway, one of the most horrific places they've been doing this is up at Bristol Zoo, where the wink and the nod have been given to the Bristol Zoo people.
Bristol Zoo is another euphemism for City Hall, I believe.
It is as well, yes, very good. But up at the zoo, which, you know, some people remember through Johnny Morris on the TV, it's one of the, in fact, is the oldest provincial zoo in Europe. They've now decided that the land is worth much more, we're putting luxury flats on it than it is as a zoo. So they've closed the zoo. The zoo has been moved out to the M5.
That's to be fun for the motorists then.
But this week there was due to be decisions on giving planning permission to this zoo, zoo development and other developments around the city. Only thing is, the planning meeting on Wednesday was cancelled. I don't know if you'd heard about that. There was a no. Yeah, this never happens. The head of planning at Bristol City Council this week has resigned. So there is obviously some pushback against the mayor just giving planning permission to these speculators here, there and everywhere. And it seems that he's on a mission in his last year in office, because he's going next May to make as much money for his speculator friends as he possibly can by blighting the history, but the future of the city. So there is a protest going on Sunday, a well-organised and measured one, yeah. Which is starting at the Victoria Rooms up by Clifton Triangle.
On Sunday,
And also people can come to the zoo as well if they want to hear speeches and that sort of thing.
Well, the zoo that was, you mean?
Yeah, where the zoo still about is. Yeah. Well, they want to, you know, there's a lot of people in the city that are saying, well, look, you can move some of the big animals out, but we need to keep this as a visitor attraction. You know,
but what's going to be there? Hang on. They're all right moving the animals out, but then what's going to be there?
Well, there's all the smaller animals they're thinking about keeping.
Oh, right, okay. Like the hamsters.
I think the idea is that, you know, there is a sort of general feeling that having these big animals like elephants and things like that in captivity is not a good idea. It's a bit cruel. Gorillas and that sort of thing. And so Bristol could be the place where we have a vision for the new kind of zoo, which is much more animal friendly, much more people friendly and more ethical. But no, let's have luxury flats instead. Right. So anyway, I spoke to the former mayor, George Ferguson, about this earlier on today.
George Ferguson, the first and independent mayor of Bristol, and an architect, an activist, and somebody who really passionate about Bristol and making it the best city on earth. And I feel that the planning is in a bad place in Bristol at the moment, and we are in danger of destroying our heritage in several ways, and that's not just about high buildings. And it's really important that planning is about making a better place for all. That's really important. Of course, we have to house as many people as we can. It's going to be very difficult to catch up with all the needs. But we've got to do it in a way that doesn't destroy the good things. And that is what I was very keen on doing when I was mayor. And we've got to produce truly affordable social housing. And that's why, as mayor, I started restarted the building of council houses, which hadn't happened in Bristol for 30 years, although they get stolen off us by the right to buy, which is an appalling policy that was brought in by Thatcher. And I really do feel that we ought to now rescind that, and that's something that I hope that any parties, apart from the Tory party, which for which it's unlikely, that all the other parties will sign up to finishing the right to buy, which may be good for individuals, but it's bad for society.
Anyway, George, I've actually heard some Tories agreeing with you on this right to buy thing. I think the thing is the housing crisis has reached such an extent. But anyway, look, most people do not, I mean, find the planning system boring. You know, most people don't even understand it. Can you just give us an idea of what you were doing before you were mayor and while you were mayor and how the system works?
Well, I think all the best things that have happened in Bristol are because of individuals taking action, and very few of the good things have happened as a result of the leadership, including when I was mayor, and as a result of the council's initiatives. It is about individual activists who recognise that Bristol is a special place, and that's why Bristol is a special place. So I think we have a very weak planning system, and that's a national problem. We have a weak planning system that sort of tends to give tends to the side of the developer. And of course, development is important, but it's important that we get the right development, and there isn't a presumption of passing plans that happen to hit the planning committee. We have a semi-judicial system with planning in Bristol, which is that it's not up to the mayor. Planning is meant to be a separate issue. Planning permissions are given either by the officers, if it's not thought to be important, or by the committee, the planning committee members, and there are two planning committees, A and B. And I'm afraid that the officers will tell the councillors that there is a presumption in favour of permission nearly every time. And they will say that some of the places that we really value in Bristol are brownfield sites, which then gives them the excuse to build on them. And those brownfield sites may be places of real interest and real with native plants, with flora and fauna. And so I think it's really important that we distinguish between the places that we can build on and the places we can't. And that has been breaking down. And it's also very important that we take notice of the historic skyline, which is very special in Bristol. It was rather, it was badly compromised after the war in the 60s and 70s in particular. And we are going back to some of that compromising, and with some even worse buildings, such as the building on the edge of Castle Park. There's another one threatened there of 26 stories. And so when it comes to the zoo, we have one of Bristol's most special, precious places, a walled garden of nearly 12 acres. It was probably the reason why many people in this country know of Bristol. It was our greatest visitor attraction. And we realize that zoos have changed and have to move on. But taking a zoo out of the city and making it car dependent seems to be the wrong move to me. And we need to reinvent the urban zoo. And I don't mind whether that walled garden becomes a walled garden that's run by the Royal Horticultural Society, or it's one that it does, you know, that enables us to reinvent the zoo with a virtual reality zoo or whatever it may be. I just feel that garden is really important. It's never had a car on it. And yet now we have a proposal for nearly 200 apartments, very few of which will be affordable, if any will be affordable, and 125 cars, and there will be more than 125 cars because people will drive on and park on the pavement of the roads that they're building, and we will have lost a very precious part of Bristol.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a commercial imperative, George, isn't it? At the end of the day, that land is worth money.
planning determines the value of land, and each individual councillor on the planning committee, it's on their conscience as to what happens with it. Now, if their conscience is clear to build on it, just because that will raise the value of it, if they really believe that, then they will vote to allow this planning. But if they believe that we've got something special here that helps to define Bristol, that is part of what Bristol is, that was that Isambard Kingdom Brunel was a founder of, along with some eminent Bristolians who were the original shareholders. If those councillors recognise that this is precious, they will not give that planning permission. Money can be raised in other ways. And I know that there are enough people interested in buying the zoo gardens, which would give millions to the zoo. But it won't be the same number of millions as if you build housing all over it. But we mustn't have a world that is just ruled by money. That is why we do such bad things. It's why planning should be value related in terms of the place, the people. It should add to the attraction of the city. But what we have planning by numbers at the moment, which is about the numbers of houses, which absolutely, of course, are important, and about money.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of examples around the city. There's the Temple Island, the Bridge to Nowhere, which was going to be the arena, which is now being moved apparently to Filton for some reason, even though, of course, that's way out of the city, where there's the Aerospace Museum was moved as well, and that sends all sorts of financial difficulties because it's not where the people are. It's difficult to get to up there. And I noticed that the legal and general scheme for there seems to be to put as many, this is right next to Temple Mead Station, as many tower blocks as high as possible on the smallest space of land. And the same thing seems to be happening on the west side of Castle Park by Bristol Bridge, an enormous high-rise development. And of course, this is where the planning system is, though, George. You know, if you can put as many places which people have to rent in that space as possible, which generally means going high rise. And of course, the council are looking at that thinking, well, there's going to be loads of either business rate or council tax for us in that. So there's a financial incentive from the council's point of view and from the land speculator's point of view.
No, but it's not a matter of whether we do it. Of course, we've got to build the housing. It's where and how we do it. And just to put this into proportion, we're talking about less than 200 apartments on the zoo site. We're talking about 2,000 on the Bedminster site next to York Road. We're talking about 10,000 down by around the station, around Temple, around the Temple area. So we're talking in minimal terms about the sort of numbers that the zoo site contributes, and yet so the damage is completely out of proportion to the offer, so to the amount of housing that is produced. So we have to weigh up these things. I mean, it's like the National Health Service. You've got to weigh up about where you spend the money, and what's really important is that we produce good housing that is sustainable, that lasts, that makes good communities, that is good for families and children. Not just any old housing, which is about the numbers, but the housing that's proposed for the zoo is posh, privileged housing. The PR is that the housing estate gardens will be available for the public during the daytime. There is no way that can be legally sustained forever. And in no time at all, the residents, when they move in, will be objecting to the nuisance of the public invading their gardens. And eventually an excuse will be made that will keep those gardens closed to the public. I've no doubt about that. So I think the danger is that the planners and the committee members who are in, who have their individual vote, they're not a party vote, they're an individual vote. The danger is that they are duped by the zoo and their very expensive PR. I mean, there's an article in Bristol 24/7 that is written by the zoo. It's not written by Bristol 24/7. That misleads people into thinking that there's going to be a much bigger zoo out by the motorway junction. It's not a much bigger zoo because the site may be 10 times as big. The zoo will only be fractionally bigger than the existing zoo because a lot of that land can't be used. So, and then there will be 10 acres of surface car parking out there. I mean, this is a conservation society who are destroying an awful lot of land, who are, you know, if everybody else behaved like them, we would be reaching at least 2.5 degrees higher temperatures when the world is desperately trying to keep us below 1.5 degrees higher temperature. So, yeah, there, one wonders what is the responsible behavior of a conservation society who claim to be conserving animals, but the habitat within which they are conserved is going to be destroyed by the sort of actions that they're taking.
Okay.
So, I think it's really important, Bristol, as a, as Europe's only European green capital, because there will never be another one in the UK, the Britain's only European green capital, it's really important that we live up to our name.
Yeah. Well, look, there's been a few problems this week with the zoo development, which was supposed to go before the Development Control Committee on Wednesday, along with two other major schemes, one at Knowle and the other one at the Harbourside. They've been pulled. The committee meeting was cancelled. The head of planning, Gary Collins, is deciding, well, whether he's decided, who knows, but he's leaving. His job is being advertised. There seems to be complete chaos at the council over this and other developments and planning.
Well, the problem is the mayor's office is trying to take control of planning, and they are interfering with a planning process that should be independent of them. And I think that's where an awful lot of the problems derive from. But thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. And I hope that on Sunday that people will come and show their displeasure this Sunday, either to turn up at the Victoria Rooms at 11, when is it?
10:45 at the Victoria.
10:45 at the Victoria Rooms, or to turn up at the zoo at 11:30, by 11:30, when the people coming from the Victoria Rooms will arrive, having walked there, just so that the council can understand the concern amongst families and environmentalists and others about the loss of such a precious resource.
Yeah. I mean, and it also, it indicates that there's been some big changes since you stopped being mayor, George. The website is savebristolzoogardens.org. George Ferguson, former mayor of Bristol, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So, John, that's the guy that pipped you to the post.
I know, bless him.
I mean, it's worth saying a bit about George, because he was the president of the Royal Institute for British Architects, even back in the 1970s in Bristol, as an architect, campaigning in this similar fashion, you know, to try and say, well, look, the planning system is our future, and unless we take on some of these greedy developers, people that just want to simply use the land that's valuable in our city because it's central, to make as much money as they possibly can. No, this needs to be balanced with the ability to have amenities, and that's what the whole planning system's there for.
Absolutely, and I think George was a legend, and it's a shame he didn't stay in as mayor, because I think the city would be very much different now, and I'm sure there are people out there who perhaps were against him at the time who now think, actually, I wish George was back in office.
Well, that's right. 8 years ago, he was pipped at the post by Marvin Rees for the Labour. But, I mean, this is largely because the Conservatives were so disliked nationally that Bristol voters saw an opportunity to vote in a Labour mayor here.
Mm. And I think they made a mistake. Same as I think, really, when Barbara Jank was mayor, I think the Liberal Democrats were doing
well.
Very,
she was council leader, to
well,
be fair.
Yeah, no, council leader.
And that's the system
right.
we're going back to next
year,
apparently.
Yeah. And I think the Lib Dems actually did a pretty good job as well. And it's a shame they lost. But however, George got in and, you know, whatever people might say about him, he was a very honest man. He was always upfront about what he was going to do. There was no hidden agendas with George.
I remember him also turning up at the anarchist book fair. Do you remember that?
Yeah, you either liked him or you didn't.
And then he turned up at the anarchist book fair at the Trinity Centre and he got a cup of hot coffee thrown over him.
Yeah.
But at least he was there.
He was there, exactly.
And he was wanting to engage with people of all political bents, wasn't he, and persuasions.
I know, and it's such a shame he's gone, because I don't think the city would be in the mess.
Well, the thing is, in a way, he hasn't gone, because he's been galvanising support for this campaign against this luxury development.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does certainly look as if it may have been involved in this decision this week to cancel the planning. The planning committee. I mean, if George is right, and Marvin Rees and Kevin Slocum up at the mayor's office are trying to take control of the planning system in Bristol, which is supposed to be judicially independent, it could possibly be like a showdown, really, between the legal framework for planning and the mayor's office.
Yeah, I know, but my fear is that you know, when people leave to go on this march on Sunday, that they'll end up at the zoo site and find a big brick wall to bang their heads against. You know, that's my concern.
Well, what do you mean?
I just don't.
You don't think they're going to get anywhere with this?
No.
Well, I think they may well do, because I mean, if it's come to the resignation of the head of the planning on Bristol City Council, and he's decided he's had enough, he's walking away. It sounds to me as if he's being lent on to make decisions which may be illegal.
Doesn't it just prove to...
Unlawful, maybe.
All right, but doesn't that, again, just go to prove how, and I use the word loosely, corrupt this council is?
I think you're right. I remember years ago being in a lift at an awards ceremony. Somebody from another council, I think it was Liverpool, was saying, "Oh, you're from Bristol. You're so sorry for you." We always get tales of corruption from Bristol. It's one of the most corrupt city councils in the country.
Yeah.
I was like, "Was it?" I didn't realise that. But anyway, look, let's have a look at some of the other problems going on here in the city. Since you're here, since you're not mayor, you can still talk about these things. Bristol's bus network is near collapse, says Bristol 24/7. In fact, this is in the Post as well, I think. There are all sorts of problems with the buses, aren't there? And there have been lots of calls to bring back in the whole franchise system.
I thought they were being replaced with tuk-tuks.
With what?
You know, there's tuk-tuks, those little things out in the Far East with three wheels that they ferry people around on.
Anyway, this is Labour councillor Mark Bradshaw having a pop at his mayor, saying he's never seen anything on this scale in his 17 years on Bristol City Council. Speaking at a West of England Combined Authority audit committee, members are airing serious concerns about routes that would soon be lost from April, many in poorer areas. Bedminster councillor Bradshaw narrowly missed out on becoming the mayor candidate against Marvin, apparently. But it says that... unique distinction of being sacked from both George Ferguson and Marvin Rees's cabinets. He told the meeting, "There's a real crisis in passenger transport in our region. There seems to be a near collapse of the bus network. I've never seen anything on this scale." And what he's referring to, of course, is the fact that we've got this clean air charge. A lot of people are saying, well, if I can't use my car in the city centre, well, hang on, the bus is cancelled too.
It is an absolute... Is it a show? In which case, I apologise if I've offended anybody by using it, but I cannot think of better terminology for this city.
Well, corrupt.
Well, okay, we'll use corrupt then. Although I think...
The priorities are all wrong. It seems to me we've got a mayor that his priorities are around lining the pockets of the rich and planning speculators. I mean, we had Simon Killane, who was a councillor in Malmesbury a couple of weeks ago, saying, well, there's no gold mine in Malmesbury anymore, and there's no no silver mine. But what there is planning permission.
Yeah.
And with planning permission, you can turn a piece of land that's worth maybe £1 million into one that's worth 500, you know, 700, yeah, nearly £1 billion.
Yeah,
because
this is a way of
decision going through the council, and suddenly whoever owns that land, as you know, they hit the jackpot. Basically, they can multiply their investment by 100.
There's a boxing site up Eastern Way that kind of rings bells there. But anyway,
what are you referring to?
Isn't there a boxing sort of gym site up near Eastern that's, you know, been the subject of some discussion in private eye about the land value?
Oh, right, that's right. Yeah, well, this is a piece of land that the mayor has given to his boxing club that he was boxing at. It's worth about £1.3 million.
Mm, yeah. A nice piece of asset there. But anyway, let's get back to the transport. What's happening is it's hitting the people with the lowest incomes. And that is the sad... I mean, let us take, for instance, the homeless charities who bring their vans into the city every day to feed and clothe the homeless that have to pay this clean air zone charge, who are now forced to be going out of business. And where does that leave the homeless if they're not going to get their meals or their clothing on a daily basis? It affects the low-paid, on-benefits people. It affects carers who need to get in and out of the city in order to do their shopping. All of this hits the people who can least afford it. And what about the one-man band self-employed who suddenly can't find it to go out and replace a boiler or whatever? He's going to have to carry a new one on the bus with all the ladders and whatever else he needs. It's ridiculous.
It is insane. Now, I won't use your term, but it certainly does seem to be a bit of a mess at City Council at the moment, particularly the idea that something like the planning committee has to be cancelled, the chief planning officer has to go. Something's obviously going on. The gold mine is not delivering the gold it was supposed to deliver. So I'm going to run through a few stories to do with the mess that Bristol City Council seems to be in under Marvin the Marvellous Mayor.
The Mayor.
The what?
We can say
the
Mayor.
Yeah, we could say that, yes. the smelly marsh, how about that?
Yes. The excrement that hits the fan.
I hope it is, yeah. It's about time, yeah. Police investigate alleged fraud at Avonmouth Recycling Centre. Well, this is the tip, basically, for big lorries that take rubbish down to Avonmouth, some of it which gets burnt and incinerated. And it's rather hilarious that you've got a clean air zone in a city where just upwind of you, you've got an incinerator chucking out poison into the air, and that which has been given planning permission by the council, and they seem to love them. Yeah. But anyway, what's been going on up there is the drivers of these waste lorries have been passing cash to the Bristol Waste Council employees at the gate, and they've been saying, oh, well, he's got lots and lots of waste here, or he's not got any waste here, or whatever, so that they don't have to pay the charges. Now, this is the mob.
This is exactly
how the mob operates, isn't it?
Backhand money.
Yeah, so that's been going on.
Well, why am I not surprised, you see?
Council could scrap its companies amid very serious concerns about Bristol Waste's future.
Well, they made such a go of the electricity company, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, that's right, electricity company. We've got a waste company that's supposed to be emptying the bins.
But they can't run a council, either.
And I've got a house building company. All of them are in deep trouble.
By the way?
Well, apparently there are a few houses have been built. I mean, there was a private development that the mayor was, Marvin was saying was going to be fantastic, down at what's called the Boat Yard, on the Bath Road, just along the side of the River Avon here.
And the one that's sinking into the river.
That's right. Yes, it's a massive subsidence underneath it. And so is it not going to be affordable housing, 17 stories or something of affordable housing, but they built it right out over the river, and now the bank of the river is starting to subside, so one does wonder whether the whole thing is just going to tip into the river, and a few boats might be in a moor on the balconies of the, you know, slanted sideways.
I think you're on the verge of having Bristol's answer to "Have I Got News for You" here.
The council could scrap its companies, as I've said, and also no analysis has been done on bringing the buses back into public control. Well, this is the Wecker mayor, Dan Norris, who said that we have two mayors, we're so lucky around here. He's of a wider area than Marvin the mayor, and he is supposed to be in charge of public transport, and he's supposed to have been doing some plan in order to bring the buses back into public control.
I like your use of the word supposed.
Yeah, because apparently it's not been done. There has been no analysis done on bringing the buses back under public control, despite the West of England Metro mayor's claims. So he's saying it has been done. Other people on the committee at the West of England mayor say it hasn't been done. And so as a result of all this, now bickering and mistrust lands Wecker, West of England Combined Authority, on a government watch list. So they're saying that this is so dysfunctional, this new, well, it's fairly new, it's about ten years old or so, that the government is keeping a very close eye on it, because they think that they're actually dysfunctional and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, despite all the public money that's been shoveled
there, really,
in their direction. Really. Another West of England council has called for franchising bus system for the Bristol region. Of course, this is because the bus system is collapsing and
they're having a Uber type service, I believe.
As we see quite often here, as our engineer Dave, we were waiting for the bus for him in the evenings, quite often we'll see a bus appearing on the screen, and it's going to be 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes,
2 years.
No minutes. And then it says it's due, no bus arrives, and then it says 30 minutes.
And then three buses
arrive. And so it's what they call the ghost bus. So there's no actual real bus there, but it's there on the system. And one wonders whether they're getting paid, you know, for that bus running.
You know, I tell you, I got one for you. Right. I know a few bus drivers who have been with the company a long time. And what West of it, this bus company is doing at the moment.
This is First Group, isn't it?
Thank you. Yeah, First Group. They're using agency drivers at £200 a day, right, who also get their hotels paid for. And these agency drivers travel around from city to city, making a grand a week in their pockets and having their accommodation paid for. I mean, what a fantastic life. We should all be doing this. Right, so that's how the local bus service is run at the moment, on agency drivers being paid a grand a week, far more than your employed bus drivers are making, and coining it.
Meanwhile, Marvin, the marvellous mayor, this week has said there will be a underground system here in Bristol.
Oh no,
Bristol.
You're joking.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. All those promises that I made when I first became mayor, they were really all true. And of course, there are other people who are saying, actually, the rock round here is not suitable for building underground. So anyway, the rapid transit, Marvin is saying, could be only £7 billion, but partly underground.
I see a pig passing above our heads as we speak.
Well, we did hear about things like powerboat racing in the floating harbour, didn't we? But that never happened. So what do you think is going on? It's a kind of almost like it looks to me a little bit like a kind of the mayor's meltdown.
Look, this idea of, have you heard that the recent cost of HS2 that are going absolutely through the roof, and this lunatic of a mayor thinks it's a brilliant idea to tunnel under Bristol through hard rock to build this rapid transport system that's presumably going to be... It's delusions of grandeur.
Well, we had trams during the Second World War.
Yeah, fine.
In fact, if you go to St. Mary Redcliffe Church, which I call the Masonic Cathedral, but if you go around into the gardens, the churchyard there around the back, you can see one of the tram lines actually sticking out of the ground, because a bomb hit it in World War II and it flew right up in the air, hundreds of feet in the air, and it landed in the churchyard, and it's still sitting there. But this was the way everyone got around. It was a mass transit system, and it didn't have to go underground at all.
You go to other cities like Nottingham, they've got fantastic services, like Manchester's got fantastic services. And this delusional guy, you know, I mean, I don't know what kind of, if at all he's on any medication, but it's certainly not helping him if he is. wants to now tunnel under this city at a cost. And you know what it's going to be like. It'll say, oh, well, it's going to cost 50 million. And then a year on, it's, oh, now it's going to cost 80 million. And the year on, well, actually, now we're very sorry, as a 2-year hold up, and, you know, we couldn't get past XYZ, so now it's going to be 150 million. I mean, the guy is absolutely delusional.
Okay, well, we're going to move away from Bristol now and look plan to build 15-minute cities. And this is an idea which
Say it again. Build a what?
15-minute cities.
So they're going to build a city in 15 minutes?
No. You're going to be within 15 minutes of everything you need.
Oh, I see.
And the idea is to create zones in the city where you don't need to travel around in the city. Right. You only need to stay in your zone. And if you do decide you want to drive out of your zone, you have to pay.
It was a segue between Marvin's delusional underground railway and building a city in 15 minutes that confused me.
That's right. Well, a 15-minute city isn't quite that, although it might be in this crazy modern world.
In Bristol,
So I thought we'd have a listen to a young girl, 12-year-old girl from Oxford. Oh, actually, no, she was speaking in Oxford. She's not from Oxford. Where she explains why she thinks this is a ridiculous idea that they're trying to bring in. Oxford and Canterbury are two of the cities that they're starting to bring this in. But they're saying, well, look, why is it good? And it's like our clean air zone. Why is it a good idea to say that people can only travel within that particular zone and they're not allowed to go from one zone to the next? Why is this supposed to be a good idea when obviously it's going to make people travel further and cause more pollution?
My advice to the British people is, do not trust this person to tell you the truth. He is a greedy person and only has his own selfish interests at heart. His pals at the World Economic Forum are quite openly calling us, we, the people, useless eaters and a waste of resources, adding, they do not need the vast majority of us. They don't need us. Well, quite honestly, I think the whole of humanity would be much happier and much better off without them crazy lunatics. We don't need them, and we don't want them. As long as Klaus Schwab is free, no one is safe. Then, there are the foolish people. These are the ones who are helping to build their own prison and the prisons that their children will have to spend their whole lives within, being watched as digital slaves and tracked 24 hours. Every second of their life where privacy will soon become incomprehensible. I'm speaking about those well-paid officials at Oxford City Council who think they have the right to force their madness on the rest of us. And then there's the destruction of local small businesses. Businesses that depend on the free flow of traffic and the freedom of the people to move around and go about their lives freely as they choose in order for that small business to survive. I could talk about the ignorance of these investors in the creation of these prison systems. Large corporations such as Lloyds Bank and organizations who are acting in shameful and ungodly ways through ignorance and through corruption. Organizations such as the Church of England, who I am sure would have no part in this if they knew where it was all leading. Again, we see the blind leading the blind. All I can think of saying is, oh my God. Do any of you know what is fast approaching? Let's say my friend lives in Zone 3 and I'm in Zone 1. If, for example, I went to my friend's house in Zone 3, my parents normally come and pick me up in their car. It only takes 10 minutes. So does that mean that they would have to go round the ring road and back into town again? If my mum or dad had to drive round the ring road, it would take 30 minutes, causing much more pollution and leaving a much bigger carbon footprint. They will say, you can walk home. Would that be safe? For me to walk home, me as a 12-year-old walking home in the dark alone, is that really going to be safe? Then they will say, oh, don't worry about that. We've already thought of that. You'll be safe. We will have 1,000 cameras on the streets following you and tracking you all the way home. Oh, and just remember, it's for your safety. What? Are you serious? Do you really think I want to be watched every second of the day? Are you serious? Thousands of cameras tracking my every move until I get home. At this point, I have to ask, is my safety that important to me that I want to be followed by cameras all the way home? Or do I prefer to have freedom than privacy? And also, for your information, I still wouldn't feel safe. No amount of cameras is going to stop someone who wants to attack me. I want to be safe, but not to the extent that I'm prepared to give up my freedom and my privacy to have it. Anyone who gives up their freedom for safety deserves neither. As a 12-year-old, I am really concerned about my future. And to Klaus Schwab, I say this. How dare you! How dare you steal my childhood and my future, and the future of all children by enslaving us in your crazy digital surveillance prison. We all know where this is leading. And by the way, Klaus, just for information, I still think you're a complete nutcase. How dare you? Who do you think you are? To me, you are no different from a villain in a James Bond movie, attempting to hold the world hostage in your crazy transhumanist dystopia. And for what? To make more money? More profit? Is there truly any amount of wealth that will satisfy your greed? So people, listen. Make no mistake. These are the first steps of a dystopian reality called 15-minute neighborhoods. From a small seed, a huge tree can grow. Do you know yesterday the temperature was 7 degrees, but today it is 12 degrees? The greedy people are claiming that the zones are to do with climate change. Over the last few decades, the greedy people have managed to convince the people of the world that if the temperature goes up by one single degree, that all life will become extinct. How dumb have you got to believe that?
So that's Jasmine. Played.
I like her.
another clip from her, recorded in Oxford a couple of weeks ago at the 15-Minute Cities protest. What did you make of that then, John?
I thought she was articulate, I thought brilliant and hilarious for a 12-year-old.
Well,
and she should be Prime Minister next.
like Greta Thunberg, there are questions about whether she wrote, did she write that, or is she just reading something that someone else has written? What do you think, listening to it?
I think she's a very articulate girl, and I think she's very clever. And she may well have been given a hand by her parents just to dot the I's and cross the T's.
Well, I think she's
got it.
You're right, actually, because I did track down one of her parents, Ian Spence, who's Jasmine's dad. And I put that question to him about, did you write this or did she? And he said, well, actually, she wrote it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was there just giving her a hand with some of the phrases and things like that, but it was absolutely her, and she insisted on it being her that was in charge. So anyway, let's have a listen now.
Do you think we could get her as next voter in as next mayor of Bristol?
I think it's quite feasible.
I do. I like the idea. I think we should get a campaign together
as long
tomorrow.
As there's still trains running and that she can still get into work, although she doesn't have to walk or go on a bicycle. Anyway,
no, I think we should start a campaign tomorrow.
So anyway, let's have a listen to Jasmine's dad, Ian Spence, now talking about a little bit about what he thinks, because it was interesting to actually, in the longer interview I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight, where he talks about how much he actually helped her or not. Here he is explaining a bit about, his daughter, who I nicknamed Better Than Greta.
They've told us themselves over the years that they want to get rid of the useless eaters.
Well, so who is them?
Well, I can't remember who it was, but years ago I saw something from a woman speaking out, and she was apparently one of the Rothschilds, and she said, soon it's going to be time to get rid of the useless eaters. That was around 2014-15. But this depopulation talk has been going on since 2010, so I was aware of it all that time ago. Now, the thing is, if it wasn't the depopulation, why are they covering up all the adverse events?
What, you mean from the jabs?
Yeah.
Well, good question. I mean, maybe just to protect the pharmaceutical, the profits.
So, if that's the case, then why are they saying they're going to be doing more of it?
Well, good question. So anyway, look, Ian, what do you think we should do?
I think we need to blend it. Well, what do I think we should do? Those people need arresting, really. They do need arresting. But we got a problem because, the military, even ex-soldiers know, some ex-soldiers are awake and they know what's going on. So the generals, what are they doing? Why are they not doing anything? Why is the chief of police not doing anything?
Well, a lot of them are just worried about losing their jobs, aren't they?
Oh, what, they put that before their children's lives?
Well, I know during the pandemic, whatever you want to call it, during that, we had a very interesting question was raised. And that was that not all doctors become doctors because they want to help people. Some of them do it because there's a lot of money in it. What things should we be looking out for in the next couple of years that would indicate that Jasmine is right and there really is some sort of conspiracy out there? She used the word evil to enslave us. So what things should we look out for which might give us evidence of that?
DGID, the CBDCs, because we know they're programmable, and once those two things are in place, then they will attach the injections, the mRNA injections, with that. So you won't be able to go to a supermarket unless you get the injections. You won't be able to feed yourself. You won't be able to go to your bank. You won't access your money. You'll have nothing. You'll have no life. And this is why we need to stop it. It's either that or we have to run away to a country where this isn't going on,
I mean, you're portraying there is basically a system of slavery.
Yeah. Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, DGID, CBDCs that are programmable, allowing you to buy this, not buy that, and you can do that, you can't do that. And then with the, it's really about depopulation, I think. I don't see any other reason why they would bring out these injections, They are toxic by design.
So that is Ian Spence, father of Jasmine, and you can get an idea of where she gets some of it from. But certainly according to him, it's really her words. She just gave him a hand, but yeah. It's her ideas. You could certainly feel the passion in her voice.
Absolutely. Listening to her, and I, without wanting to give myself a massive plug, but there's a lot of what she says that's actually in my book about the way things are going. I can side with her on a lot of what she says.
What do you make of this whole idea of the greedy people? She's saying, well, look, I'm not interested in the problems with the climate, the economy,
yeah,
Ukraine,
yeah,
whatever. Yeah. Actually, there's a problem. The real problem is these greedy people.
Exactly. And I've referred to that in my book. And I think there is an imbalance. There is too much greed. And we live in a world of me, me, me. We want this, we want that.
But saying that, we could be in a sort of slavery system where unless you've got the right dots on your digital ID, you won't be able to eat. That's another stage entirely, isn't it?
Isn't that sort of veering towards where China is at the moment? Absolutely. Everything's a plug for my book, isn't it?
Go on, if you can, that's fine, yeah.
But, please. I've gone into this, and it bothers me that we live in a world that has become so dependent on materialism, so dependent on goods and how much we have. And that is a major cause, I think, of the problems that we have. And a lot, as I say, is what I call ego-driven.
It's also most insecure people, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, we've got somebody who's not insecure, or at least we hope he's not, anyway, because he's about to become coronated as King of the United Kingdom.
Oh, I think you're talking about your producer
of Great,
here.
Of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That is King Charles. He's going to get his coronation in May. Will you be going, John?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been given, you know, first-class tickets for the front of the queue there.
The problem is there's been...
I've even beaten those two from the breakfast, you know, the mid-morning TV. Phil and what's the name?
Well, there were a few problems, aren't there? Because quite a lot of people have been pulling out of the concert.
Elton John's pulled out.
Yeah, there's a whole list of them.
Spice Girls.
Yep. And I don't know if it's, you know, how much of a success this whole thing's going to be. And I spoke to a chap called Justin Walker, who's loosely connected with the UK Column and various other campaigns.
Marvin will do a song for him.
Justin's campaign's been around something called the Bradbury Pound, which is a Treasury-produced piece of money, which is spent into the economy with no debt. Apparently, most of the money that the Treasury spends is borrowed from the banks, and therefore...
It's not like the Bristol Pound, is it?
Similar.
Oh, my God, then we are in trouble.
Dragged into... Well, yeah, but it's a national version of it, you can use to pay taxes and things like that. But the Bradbury Pound is actually a very good idea. It's the idea that the government can just spend money into the economy. It doesn't have to borrow from the city and then pay that money back, because we are going into, trillions of debt and a debt trap, a debt spiral, which means ever since 2008, the government hasn't really been in a position to do anything. It's just got to spend its time paying back all these debts and figuring out where it's going to get that money from. So anyway, Justin is running a campaign this year, at the moment actually, in the run-up to the coronation of King Charles, where he's encouraging people to download his letter and send it to the Duke of Norfolk, who's organising the coronation.
That's very nice of him.
Prince Charles, as he was then, was a strong advocate, and probably still is a strong advocate, for small, medium-sized farms. And I know he had particular support for the hill farmers up in the Lake District. When I worked for a local newspaper, I'd met farmers who had actually put him up for the night and found him to be absolutely delightful. And we know he looks after rural crafts, rural communities. That's what we're told. And he apparently has these interests. However, he is supporting something, the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset, the Green New Deal, which is a complete antithesis. It's the complete opposite to what he apparently believes in. So he is there at the forefront of the Great Reset, which is bringing in, of course, digital ID, central bank digital currencies, social credit schemes, artificial intelligence on steroids. It can lead to transhumanism. I mean, what we see being rolled out in communist China is going to be rolled out here, digital enslavement. So what on earth is going on? Because that man has supposedly spiritual values, and Julian introduced him to organic farming. This is the thing I don't understand, Tony. How can a king who supports the things that we believe in can be the public figure for the Great Reset, which is bringing in a digital tyranny? Now, at the coronation, he has to take something called the coronation oath. Now, we've not had one for 70 years, so it's a bit of history for people. They don't know what the coronation oath is. Well, most of it is to do with protecting the Church of England, but the first bit of it is all about protecting the laws and customs of our land. And the laws and customs are the common law. We are a common law country. What does that mean? A common law country is where you have trial by jury. It means where you have a jury of your peers deciding whether you are innocent or guilty. But we're not even being told what a common law constitution entails. Magna Carta 1215 makes it quite plain that you are entitled to a trial by jury of your peers. But what we're not told is that the people can adjudge the legislation being used to prosecute. So in other words, if the politicians come up with statutes and acts, the people can actually overturn those statutes and act by finding somebody not guilty of doing something under a particular, statute. So in other words, they adjudge the actual law, the rule of society being used. And if they're not happy with it, if they think it's unjust and not workable, they can actually find the individual not guilty with the recommendation to annul that legislation and start the process to annul that legislation. That means we have a complete check over our politicians. That means the politicians are kept in their box, if you like. And the monarch also has the right to not give royal assent. If, you know, it's not automatic. You know, when they say an act's been passed, the king then gives his assent to that bill, so it becomes an act, etc. No, a king can refuse royal assent if he genuinely, or she, if it's a queen, believes that the people's rights and ancient rights
well,
and privileges...
Yeah, but sorry to interrupt you, Justin, but the opposite has been the case. Rob Evans at The Guardian has done a fantastic job over the last probably 10 years, including this stuff about the black spider letters, in uncovering Prince Charles, when he was Prince's, interference in laws. So he's basically he's got his staff going through every new law that's about to be enacted, and certain clauses that might affect him get removed, certain clauses which exempt him get added. You know, so he's been doing the opposite.
I don't know. I think he's obviously doing that behind the scenes. It's
yeah.
Not a public
well, he had been thing. Until Rob Evans in The Guardian exposed the fact that, you know, Charles has actually been altering laws before they get enacted in order to make sure. So, for example,
well,
one of his estates might have to pay more tax. You know,
the
so if his Duchy of Cornwall may have to pay more tax, he will write in an exemption to the law in it.
Yeah, but the last official time that the royal assent was not given was in the reign of Queen Anne, 1708, to stop a Scottish...
Well, yeah, but this is how clever it is. They're not giving assent. What they're doing is they're adding clauses, taking away clauses, this sort of thing.
I think you're probably correct. What goes on... What is happening, Tony, is everything is no longer transparent. No longer accountable.
Mm. Well, for example, can I just interrupt again? Sorry. For example, all the dealings from the Freedom of Information Act were supposed originally to include anything that was affecting the government that was involved royals. Charles has now managed to get himself exempted, you know, and the royalty exempted from the Freedom of Information Act, citing national security. And largely because of people like Rob Evans and the Daily Mail, you know, actually using the FOI to show what people like him and his staff are up to behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, as I said, I am no lover of the current Royal House of Windsor, or more accurately, the Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. And they only changed their name to Windsor when Gopher bombers were dropping bombs on London in 1917. So I am no lover of the Royal House of Saxe, Coburg and Gopher. And if he takes his coronation oath under God, and he says he's going to protect our laws and customs, which is our common law, but he is a signed-up member and launcher of the World Economic Forum's Great Reset, they're two totally incompatible. Something's got to give. So we have written to the Earl Marshal, who is the Duke of Norfolk, who is responsible for the organisation of the coronation, and we have said before he can take that coronation oath with a clear conscience, he has to retract. There's got to be a royal retraction, a formal royal retraction, a proper signed document retracting all his support for the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset, the Green New Deal, and every aspect of what the globalists have got planned for us. Now, he's clearly not going to retract. We know that, but it's an open letter, so we're getting people to talk about the Constitution, our common law Constitution, and we're encouraging people to get off their backsides, to actually work for their Constitution, and to get behind what we're doing.
Okay, so how do listeners actually get behind it? I mean, what do you want people to do?
Well, go to commonlawconstitution.org, and you will find the letter in a PDF. You want people to download that PDF and send it to their MPs, saying that they cannot allow the new king to take the coronation oath if he is not going to denounce the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset. Because, as I said, the two are totally incompatible.
But, I mean, it's almost like this is Prince Charles's, you know, baby. He's not going to say he doesn't want to do that.
Well, we know that. Oh, I mean, we're totally realistic. But what this is going to turn into is a massive constitutional crisis, far worse than Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson, far worse.
Well, isn't it interesting? I mean, this seems to be the way now. The accelerationists are the people that seem to pull a lot of this stuff together. But we've got a support for Ukraine, which actually seems to be creating a bigger crisis than it's supposed to solve. We've got zero carbon, which is creating a bigger crisis than it's supposed to solve. We also had zero COVID, which also created a bigger crisis than it's supposed to solve. Do I see a pattern here?
Yes, you do. And some people are saying the globalists are starting to panic a little bit because they're starting to be exposed in greater numbers. I mean, when you've got very articulate people like Neil Oliver talking about things and really stating exactly how things are, how our freedoms are being, deteriorated, and how clearly, I mean, one of the things we haven't even discussed is banking and financial matters, which is where I'm usually talking about. The fact is this, every aspect of the global financial world is in private, unelected and unaccountable hands, where these people meet, the bankers meet, in complete secrecy. Now, I'm sorry, money creation and money supply is the lifeblood of the world, for trade, for business, for communities, everything, and it's been decided upon by people who are unelected, unaccountable, and they operate in the shadows, in total secrecy.
Well, so the website is commonlawconstitution.org. That was Justin Walker. The text of his letter is addressed to the Duke of Norfolk. His Grace the Duke of Norfolk, Earl Marshal, House of Lords in London. And I'll put a link up to the letter he's asking people to send to him at thisweek.org.uk, and a link to that full interview with Justin as it goes into more detail about why he thinks this aspect of the coronation is so important, John.
Do you know, I was really quite taken by the last few paragraphs of what he said about bankers and people like that. And again, I know I'm plugging the book, but I have said, and now before I make this statement, I want to make it absolutely, totally clear that it is not something I am for. It is not something I would support. And Putin is not someone I would particularly like. However, he does not like this globalization. He is totally against the capitalism and the greed of the Western world. And there is a part of me that thinks the only way to solve it is if he actually drops a massive bomb, levels the world out, and everyone has to start again.
Putin. Well, I mean, maybe the West will drop that bomb. They want to do a bit of depopulation too, don't they?
Well, at the moment, I think Putin might be the answer. And it's a bizarre thing to say, and it's complete irony, but he may well turn out to be the actual saviour of this world and put some sanity back.
Didn't we try that once before with the flood? You know, let's start again. And it didn't really work, did it?
What, down in the southwest, you mean? Well, yeah.
No, I'm talking about Noah's flood.
Oh, Noah's flood.
Right, so let's all start again. Well, it all starts, the idea is, okay, we've got another great chance, and then we muff it up again.
Yeah, but I think there has to be a point when we have to say absolutely no. And I take your point about Noah, but I think this world now has gone too far. It's become far too about me and what I want, and it's about ego. And I think the only way that's going to solve it is if Putin launches a missile, starts a war, and then people actually do have to start again and work together, because at the moment the world is divided into cohorts and bubbles and people not working together. The world is far more divided, and that is a huge problem that needs to be sorted out.
Well, looking at one international story, because I think it's quite important, I wanted to look at it in the context of the this decision this week to at least attempt by Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, to make an agreement with President Macron about the migrants and the stopping the migrant boats coming over. I mean, the obvious thing to do would be to send detectives to find out who's organising it and arrest them. but apparently no. We're going to do other things. The funding for it, obviously, that could be stopped. That the people that are making all the money and finding out where that money's coming from. But no, that's the root cause, is the individuals who are arranging these very dangerous. I mean, I was just thinking earlier on, if you had somebody arranging boat trips from Clevedon over to Barry Island here in the Bristol Channel, and someone was doing it in a dinghy and a load of people died because there was no safety procedures whatsoever, then that person would be arrested and something would be done. They'd probably be jailed. But nothing's happening on the channel with that sort of thing. So obviously there needs to be something else happen. But looking at the bigger context, I was shocked and amazed to see what you've got with Rishi Sunak and Macron meeting over in France today is two ex-Goldman Sachs alumni. People who are from Goldman Sachs, these kind of technocrats, and it's worth
money again. You see?
Worth pointing out that Macron doesn't actually have a political party behind him. Well, he has one that was, you know, just kind of cobbled together just to fund his election as president, and of course most of his being elected as was public relations and stuff spun out in the press. Now. We've also had this piece of news, another Goldman Sachs person in the news, and not really reported over here at all. I just saw it pop up on Al Jazeera last night, is an ex-Goldman Sachs banker has been given 10 years in prison for their role in the 1MDB's fraud scandal over in Malaysia. Roger Ng, that's NG, 50 years old, Goldman Sachs employee over there, he set up a state investment fund and then he just took all the money for himself and his mates. This is the sort of thing that's going on over in the UK, but it's not being prosecuted. But over in Malaysia, they're taking it much more seriously. In a lengthy sentencing hearing, attorneys requested that the judge release Ng on time served. They argued that he'd been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Poor chap. But the US prosecutors who had asked for a 15-year sentence argued that the $35 million that he received in the scheme had not been recovered, so he's kept the money, and they're saying that he should be let out. But what we're seeing over in is basically organised crime, yeah, raping the resources of Malaysia, Goldman Sachs. Now. What's happening is we're being raped of resources here, yeah. But there's been no prosecutions. The Malaysians seem to have discovered that actually Goldman Sachs are organised crime.
Yeah. Why am I not surprised? Nothing surprises me anymore, I'm afraid.
Anyway, so let's have a look at what do you make of this migrant, the boat thing?
I actually thought about this while I was laying in bed this morning, and my thought was, well, if this is the case and we're letting these people in, why don't we just scrap passport systems, scrap border controls, just let anybody who wants to come into the country come in? What's the point of having laws? What's the point of having passports if people can just rock up?
Well, it seems to be a sort of way of punishing Britain for Brexit. That's what it seems to me. But anyway, part of the things getting worse generally and more chaotic, it's the Ordo Ab Kao Brigade we'll be hearing about at the end of the show, is that I spoke to a chap called Zeke Bond, whose daughter, she was sentenced, one of the people sentenced.
Indigo was her name.
Kill the Bill. Indigo. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Right. Yeah. At a peaceful protest. It began as a peaceful protest. She got a little bit involved, and now she's finding that she's going to have to do 10 months in prison. So let's have a listen to Zeke Bond now talking about his daughter's account of what happened at the Kill the Bill protest in Bristol, where it's worth just looking at what that protest was about. It was about the government bringing in a law which would be criminalising travellers and taking their homes. These are people who the Nazis targeted, and we've had travellers in Britain and we're quite happy to still have them. We've had them for thousands of years, and yet suddenly the government's decided that these protected group of people are going to become criminals. So it's not surprising that some people got angry about it. So let's have a listen to Zeke Bond now and talking about his daughter Indigo.
She was just there peaceful protesting, she was there with just all her young mates, so all like 19, 20, 21 plus, and they got no malice in them. They're not angry people, they're not violent, And they just basically there peacefully protesting. They're obviously a little bit drunk, some of them, and, you know, tipsy. And then it escalated. Basically, the police got heavy-handed pretty quick and started kind of roughing them up. And then when you're in a big group like that, then they obviously just started reacting to the aggression of the police, rather than the other way around. It wasn't like the defendants getting angry first. So, yeah, and then she basically there was the police put out a wanted list, and they put her face up and along with her other mates. They got high definition camera footage of all their faces and then put them out. So a lot of their people they knew basically grassed them up. The ones that thought they'd done something wrong started grassing each other up. So then they were like told, oh, that's him to go. Because they didn't have the names at first, obviously. The names of any of them. And slowly, people who didn't believe in what they were doing, but they knew the person, they'd informed the police as who it was. So then names were gathered that way, mostly by people who didn't agree with the sentiments of what they were, you know, standing up for, but knew the individuals. I had to actually hand her in up at Kingsham, because I live in Salisbury, but I had to drive her up to Kingsham and hand her over to the police. And then they arrested her. I said, why did you have to arrest her? I said, I've handed her in voluntarily. And they said, well, we won't handcuff her, obviously, because she's come voluntarily, but we still have to arrest her. And they had charged her with riot. She didn't plead guilty to riot, but she pleaded guilty to violent disorder, because she knew she kicked a few shields, you know. So she couldn't just say she'd done nothing. But then she went to trial, and it was a hung jury. She had 5 days in court, in Bristol Crown Court, and then they reached a hung jury. She basically, it then took them nearly 2 years from the date of offence to actually get her into the sentencing.
Well, hang on. Surely, I mean, if there's a hung jury, that's not actually a proper decision, I would have thought. You know, if you've got half of the jury saying one thing, half the jury something else, you know, how can you have a verdict?
Yeah, it was hung. So what they did was they said they want to do a retrial, and they set that in June. So in this time she's been working and had two jobs going, and in Salisbury, and keeping, you know, her head down. And then so they kept saying they're going to carry on prosecuting for riot and violent disorder at the same time. And a risk doing a retrial. That was set in June. Then we got like this message from the solicitor saying that they brought it forward to literally gave her a week's notice to get to leave her property, rented property, get all her stuff together in literally 1 week. Because they dropped the riot charge. So they dropped the riot charge last minute when they kept it going for 2 years. So you say if they just dropped the riot charge at the beginning, just accepted her violent disorder plea, she wouldn't have had to gone through a whole two years of mental torture and disruption, life disruption. You know, if they just said, all right, we'll drop the riot charge and go for a violent disorder.
So 10 months she's got. There is a certain amount of disquiet about how long this whole process has taken, isn't there, John?
Well, that's the state of the legal justice system at the moment. There are so many holds up and backlogs.
I mean, ridiculous. One of the basic things, surely, you know, you can't have a jury of an even number of people. You shouldn't have a hung jury. It shouldn't be possible. Although I suppose one of them might say abstain, and five say guilty, and the other five say not guilty. So it's a little bit awkward. But the other
Was a retrial.
The other thing is, I mean, just the actual extent of what actual damage that she did, one doesn't really know. But there was an exaggeration by the police at the time. I remember statements put out by the police press office saying police had been injured, and fingers broken, and things like that, damaged, hospitalised. Whereas actually, that proved to not actually have been true.
No, it was just to set an example. And it's one of those things that's a huge shame, because it started off as a very, very, very peaceful demonstration that found its way outside Bridewell, and I think a lot of people who were intent on causing trouble came in and started the disruption, which then created the melee, and people like Indigo got involved, and the whole thing turned out to be terrible. And I remember thinking at the time, well, why isn't this bloody mayor down here with his loud hailer, you know, being the mayor of the city and telling everybody to quieten down? Where was Marvin Rees? Hiding at home watching the television with his feet up, probably.
What do you think about the bill itself, though? I mean, they were saying, for example, in the trial, that the idea of the protest kill the bill was actually a threat to kill the police.
That is something I'm not aware of in terms of...
Well, the protest is called Kill the Bill, isn't it? The old bill.
Yeah. It is Kill the Bill, but I think that was greatly misinterpreted by people, because who obviously weren't aware that a bill is something which goes on in Parliament.
Okay, so travellers generally, you know, what's happening with that old traveller scene? We've got lots and lots of people living in vans in Bristol. I was up on the Downs the other day at Parry's Lane, something like 50. Some of them seem to be moving in permanently. Yeah. Got actually rather nice caravans with Calagas bottles up there, and the housing thing seems to have just failed.
Yeah, it's all gone very swish. But if you go up to the other end of Easton, up by IKEA, you will find caravans that have completely wrecked, that have been set on fire and left there. It's a very different scenario up there. And I've lived that life. I know what it's like. And it can be very, very difficult for people. But some of those people do have problems and can be disruptive. They're the ones, I think, who need the most care and attention. And some are there because they are not able to be housed when perhaps they should be. And they're the ones who should be looking at. In fact, I know somebody out at Hangrove at the moment, a girl I know, is having enormous problems with her caravan, and she's been threatened with eviction. And it's very, very difficult, because she doesn't know where she is from one day to the next. But if proper facilities were actually set up within the city or outside of the city, apart from a place up at Avonmouth, then I think it would be a very different scenario. But people need to feel secure in their homes, and it doesn't matter. I mean, I've lived in a tent, I've lived in a bend, I've lived in a gypsy caravan, I've lived in houses, I've lived in flats. And doesn't matter if you live in a tent, you need to know that you're going to be secure there.
Now, as we come towards the end, John, we've got to look at this. There's an amazing headline on the Sunday Telegraph last Sunday, which was Matt Hancock.
I've heard of him.
This guy, what he was saying on these WhatsApp messages, these incredible WhatsApp messages, is maybe we should deploy a new virus to scare the pants off the public.
Deploy, isn't that a lovely word? Like an army.
Jake Berry is a Conservative MP. In fact, it seems that actually most of the criticism for Hancock has come from the Tory party, certainly the most biting criticism. Jake Berry's an MP who has gotten very involved in this and saying Hancock was drunk on power and he must answer to the MPs. So that would be interesting to see Hancock grilled by MPs, wouldn't it? Even though he's not a minister anymore. Jake Berry has described Hancock as drunk on power during the pandemic. As he said, the former health secretary should be questioned in the House of Commons over his leaked WhatsApp messages. Comes after the Telegraph revealed the former health secretary discussed a plan to block funding for a disabled children's centre as a way of pressurising rebel MP to vote for new lockdown restrictions. Ex-Tory party chairman, this chat we're talking about, Jake Berry. It called for Hancock to be grilled over his proposals after the latest lockdown file revelations. He's the MP for Rossendale and Darwin, and he wrote on Twitter, "This is an absolute disgrace. Hancock should be dragged to the bar, the House of Commons, first thing tomorrow morning, be questioned on all of this." And speaking on Times Radio on Tuesday, he said the tactics crossed the line, calls for an apology, adding what he's effectively said is he wants to weaponise the provision of care for disabled children to force MPs to vote for his plans.
Didn't we get... Isn't the kind of where we started off when we talked about the whole business of politics being very corrupt from top to bottom? And it doesn't matter whether it's locally or whether it's nationally. And what they did was they instilled fear in people. Because once you instill fear in people, they start to do as they're told. And there was a lot of that going on around COVID.
Yeah.
There was a lot of misinformation. I mean, for example, I would hear one set of information in my left ear and then a conflicting set of information in my right ear, and I thought, why should I take any notes of this at all? And I just carried on regardless. But you could go out there now on the street, well, not immediately, I mean, you can if you want to, but you will still find people wearing masks in the open air. That's how much people were influenced.
That's right. Most powerful weapon, they say the devil's most powerful weapon is fear.
Yeah.
But, of course, we do need to be afraid of things we really should be afraid of. But it seems as if there were certain buttons being pressed. But I spoke this week to Dr. David Halpin about the Matt Hancock revelations. He talks about the whole thing. He feels, and Dr. David Halpin was involved in exposing the murder of, or he believes anyway, is the murder of Dr. David Kelly back in 2003, the government scientist who was found dead in the woods just as he was starting to blow the whistle on the dodgy dossier about the Iraq war. And David has this to say about Matt Hancock's revelations and about this game that was being played, as he sees it.
See, the mask is grossly contaminated. I was at the Oval Hospital yesterday with our dear daughter, and some people were wearing masks, some of the nurses on the ward were wearing masks. We keep touching them all the time. They're grossly contaminated. I never wore a mask, and they used to say, why aren't you wearing a mask? I said, I wore a mask as a surgeon for a purpose. They have, in fact, made our country and our world insane.
It seems to me that what's going on with using this word of deploying a virus is it's almost like a science fiction film.
It is, actually. And the thing is, it's in your face. They're very blatant about it. But it's because they have such control of the media, one of the things that has happened to people like myself, my phone's interfered with, my post has been open between Joe and myself from Torquay. They don't like it, and some of the people, I'm pretty expert actually on the. I was taught bloody well at St Mary's in immunology and virology and what have you. But some of the most leading scientists, immunologists, and virologists, they would say right from word go, this was a vile game, and they've been censored. And as you know, my dear friend Mohammed Adil, who spoke up in April of 2021, he was almost immediately stopped from working at a hospital in the Midlands and was taken off the register.
Well, I mean, does seem as if... Jake Berry, he's Conservative MP.
Canada, yeah.
No, he's the Conservative MP. Rossendale and Darwin in Lancashire, he's one of the Red Wall MPs. But he has been saying that he believes that Matt Hancock was drunk on power. Matt Hancock threatened him. He said unless that he stopped making statements which were critical of government policy, that various funding for things like disabled centres in his constituency would be withdrawn.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, but I was thinking of the Conservative MP who they've vilified and taken. He's had the party whip taken off him. What's his name? I forget now.
Andrew Bridgen.
Bridgen, yeah, a very good man, and in fact, he's got some training in the scientific.
World. It does give you a bit of an insight into how these things work with Hancock being drunk on power. I mean, Jake Berry is saying that, yes, that the health secretary,
have threatened to block disability funding to pressure him into backing his COVID restrictions. But this sort of thing, I mean, these are not medical decisions being made, David, are they?
No, there's nothing to the medicine. It's to do with, like we said at the end of our third interview, you said, what's it all about, David? I said, it's about global serfdom, Tony. So it's a very important plank for the Great Reset, for, you know, own nothing and be happy, you know, the Schwab lot. And don't forget that in October, I think it was 20th, 2019, the World Economic Forum or Foundation had a game, didn't they? They were gaming an epidemic.
Yeah, and Berry has also suggested that Hancock should be grilled in the House of Commons about the WhatsApp messages.
He should be taken to a law court, and so should the rest. If you look at Whitty, which is a strange man, he looks strange, which is smart. You know, he's an unmarried man. He's one of six brothers. You may not know this, Tony, actually, but I'm being quite blunt about it. The facts are open. He was one of six brothers. They all went to Malvern College, a pretty expensive private school. His father was a military attaché or something like that. And he was in, you know what often these attachés are in our foreign embassies, don't you? They're quite often attached to MI6. And he was in Athens, I think, during the time of the junta, probably. And he was in a car which was blown up. He was killed, along with, I think, two secretaries, actually, very sadly. But it's quite likely, I'm just speculating, it's quite likely that Whitty, growing up in a rather cold household, where these manipulations are sort of standard fare. You know, he's a strange man. What he said was absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. The masking is rubbish. I know that. In fact, it's now been shown. Well, it's been analysed by the Cochrane Library. I knew the leader of that, actually. He retired about 5 years ago from the Post. But they look at all the medical, all the evidence in the so-called scientific papers. Some of the papers are rubbish, but some are good. But they've shown that the masking does not stop transmission of the virus. You see, so there was no science. The motive was to scare the pants off people, to control them, to send them, I think, They wanted to addle. I keep saying it, actually. I see it. I look at my Sue is hypnotized by the television, which switches the box on. She becomes contained by it. She's staring at it. It's quite extraordinary. And I think it's quite common, actually, that. But if you watch the television now, between the damn programs, which are often violent or emphasizing sexual motives or whatever, they have all these trailers. And often black faces, violence, there's something sex, there's a violent thing, there's a gun, there's something. But they're changing about every 2 seconds. When I look at it, I think they're deliberately addling people's brains, particularly the young.
So there's David Halpin there, I think, particularly interesting insight into the family of Chris Whitty, who was chief medical officer, chief medical advisor or something during the pandemic. But, I mean, he's emphasising several times in there that he himself believes it was a game. You know, he used a medical mask as a surgeon, but he knew that you wouldn't stop a virus with it. You won't stop the surgeon spitting on the person he's operating on, but you won't stop a virus.
Mm. Well, speaking as someone who has emphysema, I can tell you that I didn't bother with a mask all the way through, and I'm still here to tell the tale.
How many jabs have you had?
Two, I think I had. But I just thought it was an absolute load of BS, to be honest with you.
So what if it was BS, why did you get yourself jabbed?
Well, it was advised to me by my GP that I would be better off if, I mean, I didn't want it, but it was advised to me that by my GP that I would be better off.
Was there any other way you felt coerced to have it rather than just your doctor saying it's a good idea, John?
Well, there was, you know, as I said, you know, you get one lot of information in the left ear and conflicting information in the right ear. But it was the GP who really just said, look, it would be, you know, better for you and less problems for me, to be honest with you. you know, if you just had the jabs, and so I had the jabs. Yeah,
well, we do take advice from these professionals, and sometimes the advice is right, and sometimes it's just influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. Anyway,
don't I know?
This idea of, he was talking about Andrew Bridgen there briefly, David Halpin was, and one of the main points that Andrew Bridgen was making in his speech before Christmas, the MP that was then pilloried for it, was this whole idea of willful blindness. Well, it turns out that there is actually a book written all about willful blindness, which came out in 2012, written by this lady we're about to hear from, Margaret Hefferman.
In Oxford in the 1950s, there was a fantastic doctor who was very unusual, named Alice Stewart. And Alice was unusual partly because, of course, she was a woman, which was pretty rare in the 1950s. And she was brilliant. She was one of the, at the time, the youngest fellow to be elected to the Royal College of Physicians. She was unusual, too, because she continued to work after she got married, after she had kids. And even after she got divorced and was a single parent, she continued her medical work. And she was unusual because she was really interested in a new science, the emerging field of epidemiology, the study of patterns in disease. But like every scientist, she appreciated that to make her mark, what she needed to do was find a hard problem and solve it. The hard problem that Alice chose was the rising incidence of childhood cancers. Most disease is correlated with poverty, but in the case of childhood cancers, the children who were dying seemed mostly to come from affluent families. So what, she wanted to know, could explain this anomaly? Now, Alice had trouble getting funding for her research. In the end, she got just £1,000 from the Lady Tata Memorial Prize, and that meant she knew she only had one shot at collecting her data. Now, she had no idea what to look for. This really was a needle in a haystack sort of search. So she asked everything she could think of. Had the children eaten boiled sweets? Had they consumed colored drinks? Did they eat fish and chips? Did they have indoor or outdoor plumbing? What time of life had they started school? And when her carbon-copied questionnaire started to come back, one thing and one thing only jumped out with a statistical clarity of a kind that most scientists can only dream of. By a rate of 2 to 1, the children who had died had had mothers who had been x-rayed when pregnant. Now, that finding flew in the face of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom held that everything was safe up to a point, a threshold. It flew in the face of conventional wisdom, which was huge enthusiasm for the cool new technology of that age, which was the X-ray machine. And it flew in the face of doctors' idea of themselves, which was as people who helped patients, they didn't harm them. Nevertheless, Alice Stewart rushed to publish her preliminary findings in The Lancet in 1956. People got very excited. There was talk of the Nobel Prize. And Alice really was in a big hurry to try to study all the cases of childhood cancer she could find before they disappeared. In fact, she need not have hurried. It was fully 25 years before the British and American medical establishments abandoned the practice of X-raying pregnant women. The data was out there, it was open, it was freely available, but nobody wanted to know. A child a week was dying, but nothing changed. Openness alone can't drive change. So for 25 years, Alice Stewart had a very big fight on her hands. So how did she know that she was right? Well, she had a fantastic model for thinking. She worked with a statistician named George Neal, and George was pretty much everything that Alice wasn't. So Alice was very outgoing and sociable, and George was a recluse. Alice was very warm, very empathetic with her patients. George frankly preferred numbers to people. But he said this fantastic thing about their working relationship. He said, "My job is to prove Dr. Stewart wrong." He actively sought disconfirmation, different ways of looking at her models, at her statistics, different ways of crunching the data in order to disprove her. He saw his job as creating conflict around her theories, because it was only by not being able to prove that she was wrong that George could give Alice the confidence she needed to know that she was right. It's a fantastic model of collaboration. Thinking partners who aren't echo chambers. I wonder how many of us have or dare to have such collaborators.
So that is Margaret Heffernan. Sorry, Heffernan, author of the book called Willful Blindness, which is what she's saying there, really, John, is looking at the idea that people much prefer to avoid any kind of confrontation and conflict, and so as a result, they try and be friends with people who do not. I mean, even in a way, I mean, you could see it as you're looking around for people who will just simply support your point of view, rather than like our mayor here in Bristol, and not for people who will be your critical friend.
That kind of reminds me of the saying that people would rather believe comfortable lies than uncomfortable truths, which kind of sums up politics altogether. And I think, although the title sounds a bit kind of New Agey, you know, I think she's absolutely right on the button in terms of what she's saying.
Yeah, sycophants. That's the word I was looking for. Yes. Yeah, I mean, which is the idea that you're just kind of in an echo chamber. We certainly try not to do that on here. I hope agree. One person I think that did almost more than anybody else to prove just to the, what extent that you can approach someone in the street and they will do everything they can to agree with you. He used to work here at Radio Bristol, actually, a guy called Chris Morris.
Oh, Chris Morris
then went on. I worked with him up in London at Great London Radio. Great guy to work with. And I'll tell you a little anecdote about him. Right. After we've heard Chris Morris, and he used to do this thing called the feedback report every week.
He's a satirist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And he used to do the feedback report, which was he went up to people in the street and he would ask them.
He did that thing on paedophilia.
He did, yes. And Brass Eye or something.
Yeah, Brass Eye.
He did a programme called The Day to Day for the BBC, and then he went over to Channel 4 to do Brass Eye. But before that, he was in Bristol here, and then he went to GLR in London after Bristol, which is where I got to know him. And this is really where he'd go up to someone in the street, and he would say something completely absurd to them, and utterly ridiculous, and yet, amazingly, people would just sort of agree with him as if there was, it was called his feedback report. So, and on the topic of willful blindness, it's amazing just how people will kind of go along. When a microphone is stuck and a camera is stuck in their face, they will kind of go along with what they think they're supposed to say.
Late night on Cure, this is. I'm Chris Morris. This is your local BBC station, and here's tonight's first feedback report. Topical question, not surprising today that we're looking at the issue of wind obedience. What do you feel of the state of it at the moment?
Well, it's a bit disobedient, definitely, isn't it?
It's really rather sad, isn't it, when that wonderful power could be put to such good use.
Oh, yeah.
For example, we could contain it in those storm bags.
Oh, yeah.
Would you agree with the comments of Professor Gus T. Day, who said that we should be making more use of this stuff that's going to be around?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, to harness it?
Yeah.
And perhaps ride it around the Grand National Course?
Well, something like that, yeah.
And if we directed its power, we could use it to make beds?
Yeah, yeah.
Prop up tables with a directional jet of it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's all sorts of things, isn't it?
And even to comfort small people who wish they were a bit taller?
Yeah.
Here's tonight's feedback report number 2. Particularly interested to know your feelings on big noise powder.
I think the noise is too much.
Should it be allowed?
It shouldn't, no.
It should be quieter.
Very much quieter.
What colour should it be?
I think it should be something that sticks out so that people know what it represents.
Yeah, like what?
Red.
And what colour?
Shouldn't it be?
Black.
What do you think it should be carried in? Big noise powder.
Well, it should be kept in airtight container.
How much should one individual be allowed to carry?
Very, very small quantity.
Number of grams?
Between 1 and 20.
So there's a couple of examples of Chris's ability to get people to agree in the street to almost anything, John.
Marvin, you mean?
Not necessarily. He doesn't seem to. Maybe you should employ Chris Morris to do that job for him.
Perhaps he could do his PR.
I think he probably would. But the only thing is, you know, where would we be with Chris? But look, I mean,
we'd have a hell of a better time and laugh about it.
Well, maybe. But the point with Chris is he managed to just convince people to kind of go along with whatever nonsense he used to come out with. And when I first got asked to work on his program, I had quite a difficult, it was on a Saturday in London, and I was taking the phone calls, and he used to do this quite clever thing where he'd say, well, just write down the phone numbers of the first couple of people that give the right answer to the quiz. I think it was a 3-hour show, and we'll call them back in the last 15 minutes. So he would only operating the phones. I would be feeding through just only wrong answers to him for the whole programme until right at the very end of the programme. We'd phone these people back.
That's COVID for
it
you.
It was just a good, you know, he was kind of just, he wanted like a cat with a mouse to play with these various people who got the questions wrong. And so he was able to play with the audience a little bit in a kind of harmless way, really.
Would you not think the government would play with us over COVID?
Yeah, but this is why I'm talking about this. He is taking advantage of the fact that people will believe stuff, and he's actually making an entertainment program out of it.
And Boris is brilliant at that. Don't you think so?
How?
Don't you think Boris is brilliant at that? He was a real stage performer. He had the gift of the gab. He could make things jocular while being serious at the same time and rally that support and get people behind him. He was brilliant at that.
He certainly seemed to be quite good at it. But anyway, a point I'm really trying to make here is that how amazing it is that you can get people to sort of say and believe and do almost anything. And people just don't want to have that confrontation that says, well... And so I worked on this programme with him for the first, 3 hours for the first week on a Saturday up in Marylebone High Street. And I just found him really difficult. He'd come through, and he'd asked me these various questions, which were rather like the ones he's asking the public. You know, you think this is complete and utter rubbish. And the second week, I just thought, this is, you know, I've got to be kind of reasonably polite to the guy because I'm working for him. You know, my job relies on this. And at the beginning of the second week I was working with him, I said, will you shut the F up? You're talking utter B, yeah? And don't think you can fool me, you know, anyway, so I started shouting.
So you lost your job then?
I started shouting at him. And you know what? He came over, he gave me a pat on the back, and we got on like house on fire after that.
Yeah.
But you see, it does take that sometimes to acknowledge that. I think he went to a Jesuit school or something like that.
Oh, same as me.
Sophisticated chap, I think. No, it wasn't Wimbledon. But anyway. So, anyway, John, anyway, any last thoughts before we say goodbye to you? We're going to have a break now.
Well,
the book, you've got to just plug the
book. Obviously I'd like to thank you for the opportunity of inviting me in. I hope I've made some sense of some things anyway.
Unfortunately, no.
Well, there we are, you see. That's for the next book. How I Failed on the Friday Show.
So it's called The Sexual Philanthropist.
Right, it is called The... Now, there is a kind of website up at the moment, and it's been up there for the last year while I've been trying to flog this thing, flog the idea of it. And it's the-sexual-philanthropist.com. And it basically gives you a sort of a review, if you like, of what the book's going to be about. However, the real deal, which I'm told by... Amazon is going to be up within the next like 24 to 48 hours and be listed, is the sexual philanthropist. And it's about sex, politics, homelessness, alcoholism, drugs, comedy, show business, humor, a great deal of humor and satire, and the dead body in the trolley. There we are. How's that?
Thank you very much, John. So the website is the-sexual-philanthropist.com, and you can also get his book on Amazon
over the weekend
if you feel so inclined. Poem from Patrizia. It's called More Conniving Every Day. Rishi Wefman is on board, handing loot away. The scam is on, our money stolen, the pillage just goes on. 3 years of this thieving, a war dressed up as a con. Zell seen looking bloated, standing outside number 10. Seems all the hoodlums that we see go to hang out in this den. Our country all but broken by vile devils in dark suits. God help us, please, God hear us, and give WEF demons your big boot.
My song shall be alway of the loving kindness of the Lord. With my mouth will I ever be showing thy truth from one generation to another.
You can come to him, whatever state you're in. I know it can be hard to let go of the past when for all the sun is shining. All you can see is darkness. Then you should take a look through the eyes of your heart. Their things are not the same. It's the devil playing a mind game. When life gets dark, I'll point you to the poor, sick or blind. He won't pass you by. Or the king upon his throne, or the man that has no home. You can come to him, whatever state you're in. Jesus loves you.
He loves you.
Though you're broken, he loves you. Poor, sick, or blind, he
Deep Purple from the year 1973, from a woman from Tokyo. Before that, Thine Be the Glory of I think it's St. Thomas Belfast Church, singing that with a lot of gusto, which is the way that song needs to be, that hymn needs to be sung. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, but please not Google. With me, Tony Gosling. No Martin this week. Martin is off ferrying some of his family around, so he can't be with us. I suppose we could have him on Bluetooth in the car driving around, but it would be a little bit hectic and unnecessary. We've got to be finished fairly soon. Only another half hour to go, and I thought maybe what we could do is whip through some longer clips, which are in a bit more detail of some of the things that are going on around the world. I think, you know, the obvious thing to do is to start with Ukraine, and we've had a guest on here, a guy called Don DeBar, who used to work on Pacifica Radio. Now he still does some radio stuff over in the US, in New York. And Don DeBar spoke to, well, I would say someone who's a bit of an old friend of mine, actually, a guy called Mark Sloboda. He used to work for the US military on their nuclear weapons sites. Not sure exactly what he did. I'm not sure if he's even told us what he did, but he was working in the US military nuclear weapons. And then he decided to actually go over for a while. He's married a Russian, and he's now a commentator. He was working on RT, and he's now a commentator on many press outlets that you don't get in the UK, including this radio station KPFK News, which Don works. He also teaches at Moscow State University too. Fascinating guy. And we had him on here when the Ukraine war first started, and he was absolutely adamant. He said this war's never going to finish. Remember, we had various people who said, oh, it's only going to last a few weeks. No. And I think Mark has been proved a year on to be pretty correct. So let's see what he's got to say about Ukraine this week, talking to Don DeBar.
Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. There's three things together. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world is the jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it. The Europeans has to be much more engaged with the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, speaking at the inauguration of the new European Diplomatic Academy in Bruges, Belgium, last October. He was articulating what many around the world say is the view of European elites of their role in international affairs. The synchronization of the role of the EU with U.S. foreign policy, in particular with respect to Russia and China, has many saying that Europe has been captured by the neocons in Washington. We spoke with international affairs analyst Mark Sloboda in Moscow about that proposition via Skype on Monday.
Mark, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you. Let's take a look at the landscape across the western side of this little battle.
Part of the news this weekend, nothing earth-shattering, but those paying attention to international relations may have noticed that the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, he visited Washington. And he had a couple of days of serious meetings with the U.S. President Joe Biden, absent the usual fanfare of a state trip. This was a down-to-business meeting. And the two, I think, do have a lot of business to attend to. For one, Olaf Scholz is trying to hemorrhage the flood of German businesses fleeing Germany to the United States.
Over energy costs, one thing, big thing, right?
Yes. A big part of it is the energy crisis because of the blowback of Western sanctions on Europe. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, which cut off gas flow further to Germany, Europe is now scrambling to find energy around the world, a limited amount, nowhere near their needs of American liquefied natural gas, that is four times as expensive as by the time you transform it, ship it across the sea and retransform it into a usable form, then the pipeline gas that Europe was getting from Russia. And on top of that, to rub salt into the wounds, as it were, Biden has initiated the Inflation Reduction Act, which sounds a little strange. It's basically a protectionist measure. It is going to be subsidizing business, any business, to do among other things. It will be subsidizing business to do manufacturing in the United States. And a whole lot of, Germany is an export-orientated economy, a lot of heavy industry, but that is also extremely energy-intensive. And now they're faced with the prospect that they are going bankrupt, that they can no longer continue operating and making money and being competitive in the global market with energy costs that they will have to pay in Germany for the foreseeable future now, with no light at the end of the tunnel. So part of what Scholz is doing is complaining that on top of everything else, that this Inflation Reduction Act is actually encouraging German businesses. And in the last week, we have actually heard as well out of the pages of the Washington Post that Joe Biden is actually in the scramble to build up their country's military industrial capacity to meet the challenges of an unending flow of armaments like artillery shells, of which they are lacking to the Kiev regime for the conflict in Ukraine, that Biden is now actually encouraging Scholz to set up military, German military production in the United States, where the energy is cheaper and this can actually be done. And all of this comes as the Germans are steadfastly, it's obvious they know, but are ignoring the fact that their ally and hegemon destroyed their own energy pipelines that they have just invested billions in building alongside Russia, to bring energy to their country. And a lot of people ask me, Mark, how can the Germans have sacrificed their sovereignty so much that they just take this? There's no calls for, in fact, there's every measure to shut down an investigation. There will be no U investigation allowed. There will be no investigation in the Hague. Why? Everyone knows what happened even before Seymour Hersh's article came out, pointing the finger squarely at the U.S. and going into a lot of details about how the operation was done.
But there's a military occupation. That's why. That's how.
There has been a military occupation. Other than, you know, the normal sordidness that goes along with a U.S. military base anywhere, I think we can say that it is, you know, it has been a fairly soft military occupation with full willing consent of the German government for decades.
Right.
But I'm more concerned about another type of occupation that has occurred that I think explains how willingly the Europeans, Germany, not only Germany, but the other European countries as well, are increasingly laying down their own sovereignty and foreign policy independence in full thraldom to U.S.-led Western global military hegemony. It's reached a state with this Ukraine crisis and a changing of the guard of leadership in the EU. I think it's best to keep in mind that this is not the EU leadership of Chirac and Schroeder that stood alongside Putin within the living memory of a lot of us oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq. At least rhetorically, right? You know, right. At least politically, not that they, you know, actually did anything to stop it at the time. This is not even the Europe of Angela Merkel, whom was ambivalent, I believe, about the Nord Stream pipeline, but she understood that her businesses, German business, German industry wanted this pipeline and needed the energy. So she went along with it and she never did anything, you know, to kill it. This is the Europe now of political figures like Annalena Baerbock another example, a perfect example would be Austrian Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg and the EU High Foreign Policy muckety muck Josep Borrell. These people, I want to read you a quick quote by Borrell that he made last autumn. Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. The rest of the world is not exactly a garden. Most of the rest of the world is a jungle, and the jungle could invade the garden. The gardeners should take care of it, but they will not protect the garden by building walls. Right? He goes on and says, the jungle has a strong growth capacity, i.e. Africa has a growing population.
Yeah.
They're breeding too quick is what he's saying, and the wall will never be high enough in order to protect the garden. So the gardeners have to go to the jungle. And he doesn't say it, but I guess prune the jungle back would be the word. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means. Now, that race, I mean, phenomenally racist, neocolonialist bile coming out of the EU high foreign policy chief. And they wonder why Africa is not backing them in Ukraine, right? We also have the Austrian foreign minister, Alexander Schallenberg, saying that Europe has been kicked out of paradise by the Russian intervention in the Ukrainian civil conflict, right? That it is a return to history. Now, these words all matter, right? Now, never mind that, of course, it was the EU along with the US that backed the violent, unconstitutional overthrow of the Ukrainian government in 2014, funded the civil, war in the country to subjugate the entire country to that seizure of power in Kiev, and then inflicted wounds on top of wounds by these self-defeating sanctions with Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister, said we're like not shooting ourselves in the lungs or foot, but shooting ourselves in the lungs. Okay. So if you take a look at all these words they're using, Schallenberg, Borrell, Baerbock, and a whole host of others, they're directly quoting the arch U.S. neocon, Robert Kagan. Right. Robert Kagan is the author, by the way, Robert Kagan, not only the arch neocon, the co-founder of the Project for a New American Century, now in with the new bipartisan Center for New American Security. He's also happens to be the husband of Victoria Nuland.
That's right.
The architect of the putsch in Ukraine and numerous others, who jumps from government to government, whether Republican or Democrat, showing how thoroughly the neocons have conquered the blob, the U.S. foreign policy elite.
That's right.
And Kagan wrote, of paradise and power, America and Europe in the new world order, the return of history and the end of dreams, the jungle grows back. And to make it even more clear, right, if you're not familiar with Kagan's work, you don't have to be. Schallenberger, the Austrian foreign minister, recently said, I sometimes cite Robert Kagan, the American political scientist, arch neocon, who said about 20 years ago that Europeans are living in a post-historic paradise of peace. And so the Russian intervention kicked us out of paradise, and one likes being kicked out of the garden.
And now they've been kicked back into history. We're going to have to get back to this next week. Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
For KPFK, I'm Don DeBar.
So that's two rather interesting types. Don, who's on this program from time to time. Mark Sloboda, really taking us through. Interesting to hear about Robert Kagan. First time I've really heard his name, come across him. But he's clearly one of these ideologues who writes stuff, not just books, but a lot of articles in the Foreign Affairs magazine, which is the magazine of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is, it's basically a privatized version of the State Department with far more money than the State Department, which was set up by the roundtable groups from the Cecil Rhodes will, very much like our own Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House in St. James in London. So these privatized versions of foreign policy, which seem to be driving foreign policy, there you see he's got his own column in Foreign Affairs magazine as Robert Kagan. And so a lot of people around the world, what they're doing, these neocons and their acolytes and the people that want to keep their jobs, just simply read Robert Kagan, parrot what he says, and then they know that they're doing the right thing. And it doesn't matter, the willful blindness, you see, this is where it all comes from. But anyway, I came across a fascinating, fascinating interview this week with a woman called Natalia Vitrenko. She actually stood to be president of Ukraine many years ago, back in the noughties, I believe, or around about early 2010s. And she's from something called the Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine. Here she's talking about the role of Ukraine in present world affairs. They are Ukrainians with a very, very, very different point of view from Zelensky, and a very different point of view to the Western media. So here's Natalia Vitrenko taking us through some of her thoughts about what's going on right now, because she's still doing blogs and stuff. Of course, we get no commentary from her anywhere on the Western press.
Today it was announced that the price of bread will soon be raised by 20 or 30%. And that's when we already, because of brutal pension and wage policies, have the most impoverished population in Europe, with the shortest lifespan. This is what comes from the efforts to set our countries against each other. And that's when Russia has repeatedly said that they have no intention of invading Ukraine. They are doing their military exercises on their own territory. But the Western media, the United States, and Great Britain don't listen to that. Even when Russia reduces the number of its troops near the border, pulling them back to their bases as the exercises finish up, it continues. They say, no, we don't see any de-escalation process. No, we don't trust what Russia says. And what is the purpose? That a war take place without fail. Who is igniting the bonfire of war inside Ukraine and from the outside? Inside Ukraine, it's the Nazis, first and foremost. All these organizations that have been reborn and burgeoned, parties, movements, organizations, thirsting for blood. They have an ideology called Ukrainian Integral Nationalism. This ideology was created by Donsov and Siborsky in the early 20th century, then implemented by Bandera and Shukhevich. This is an ideology of enmity between our peoples, an ideology of war, misanthropic war. This ideology of a Nazified Ukraine has infected a section of the population of our country. And worst of all, this ideology has become the official ideology of the Ukrainian government, just as we warned. And as a result, people with Russian culture, members of ethnic minorities, have become second-class people. Look at me. I am ethnically Ukrainian, but my native language is Russian. And I don't conceive of myself outside of Russian civilization. But all broadcasting by Russian TV channels and all broadcasting of programs in the Russian language has been banned in Ukraine. The courts, government agencies, schools, and universities work only in Ukrainian. And we have the constant fanning of the psychosis that the Muscovites, pejorative term, must be destroyed. This is said openly on television. That's inside Ukraine. And outside Ukraine, we see that the USA, headed by Biden, who is supposedly concerned about Ukraine's sovereignty, listens only to the Nazi ideologue's version, what's in their interests.
So that is the fascinating figure of Natalia Vitrenko, Vitrenko, Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine, speaking before the Russian invasion, but she's also been saying since, when Trump was still in charge, that she wants Trump to come and save them from the Nazis. So these are the Ukrainian voices which we're just not hearing from at all here in the West, which is a great pity. I mean, there's lots going on over there, of course, as usual. The media is dumping stories about Nord Stream sabotage. We've had a big day on Thursday this week of a lot of attacks by missiles all over, some of them hypersonic, all over Ukraine by the Russians. And then I noticed also that they were saying, oh, there was an attack on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Well, that is in Russian territory, so are the Russians supposed to be firing missiles at their own territory? Well, I would suggest what's going on. I mean, there are these, just John Langley was talking about earlier, he's got something in one ear that makes makes one opinion and something in the other ear that makes a different opinion. I mean, it seems to me that what's happening there is there's an attempt under cover of the Russian attack for the Ukrainians to attack the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station. Now, if that is happening, if the nuclear power station is being attacked, this is an absolutely ridiculous and reckless act by the Ukrainians to try and spread radiation and destroy a nuclear reactor. That they should be roundly condemned for it. But no, it's just treated as if it's another Russian missile. Well, of course, it's 99.9% certain it's not a Russian missile, it's a Ukrainian one. So they're looking at ways to try and turn Russian actions in this war into a news story which makes it appear that the Russians are attacking a nuclear plant, where actually it looks to me, looking at those stories yesterday, as if that was the Ukrainians doing that. So Nord Stream sabotage is trying to shift the blame from America, according to antiwar.com, since the New York Times published a story on Tuesday that cited US officials who claimed that the bombings of the Nord Stream pipeline were conducted by a pro-Ukrainian group. Articles have appeared across Western media making similar allegations. The deluge of stories has come 1 month after investigative journalist Seymour Hersh published a report that said President Biden ordered the attack on the natural gas pipeline, which connects Russia to Germany. New York Times report only mentioned Hersh's report to say US officials denied its allegations. So, you know, there's a bit of a rather pathetic attempt to cover this thing up. Certainly that's the way it seems. Ukraine, we're asked to, and I think it's really important to try and pay attention to these news stories when we hear them. If it's a Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, which is in Ukrainian territory, that's not going to be a Russian missile that hit that, is it? Or any Russian missiles that hit it, because they've already taken that part of Ukraine. They don't need to be firing missiles at themselves. We just have to be very careful, as our news media is most definitely trying its best to mislead us in any way it can. Getting towards the end now. And one of the investigations I wanted to have a look at this week was by a guy called Ken Rawdon. Now, he's a land rights activist, much after my own heart. And he runs something called Kerbear Adventures. But he's been investigating corruption down in Dartmoor about what's really behind the Dartmoor National Park Association's agreement with this hedge fund manager in order to basically to sweeten him up, because he won a high court case at the beginning of the year in order to say that people would have to pay to do wild camping on his land. Now, wild camping has been traditionally free on Dartmoor, and yet it looks as if Ken Rawdon has uncovered that this was a whole thing has been cooked up between him and the hedge fund manager, that is, and the national park, in order to actually get his way and also to funnel public money into his already bulging pockets.
Dartmoor National Park agreed with the landowners to pay them a fee to allow people to continue camping, but only in certain restricted areas and with a number of restrictions. This decision seemed to get approved and passed within a matter of days, which seemed rather odd to me in a country where bureaucratic decisions seem to take an age, so I decided to look into it further. It seemed odd that the DMPA, who are going through severe budget cuts, would so quickly agree to pay a hefty fee to Darwell and the other landowners when there were still options on the table, such as appealing the High Court verdict. I trawled through endless supplies of old documents and found that in 2021, the Dartmoor National Park Authority launched a consultation on new bylaws to reduce the areas where people could legally wild camp by 2,400 hectares, and proposing a £500 fine if you were found in the wrong spot. This caused public outrage, seeing as our national parks were created for the benefit of the public after the Kinder Scout mass trespass in the 1930s. I trawled through hundreds of pages of this consultation and found something that could just blow this case wide open. So, the consultation encompassed the changing of the bylaws in the Dartmoor Commons Act 1985, focusing mainly on restricting rights of access and wild camping rights. It started in September 2021 and lasted 6 weeks to October 2021. However, the consultation results weren't released to the public until November 2022. It's safe to say, however, that local stakeholders would have been aware of the results of the consultation well before then. By stakeholders, yes, I mean Alex Darwell, the owner of 4,000 acres of Dartmoor National Park. with close links to the local MP of Totnes, Anthony Magnell. Alex Darwall then filed his court case in June 2022, likely well aware of the outcome of the consultation. By the time the consultation was released to the public in November 2022, Darwall's court case had been filed, and most of the camping section from the consultation had been redacted pending the results of the court case. However, right at the bottom of the document, they left this, their proposal for camping. Doesn't that look remarkably familiar? Yes, you're right, that is word for word the same rules reached after Darwall's court case and Dartmoor National Park agreeing to pay them for permission to camp there. You know what else is awfully funny? Check this map out. This is a map of Dartmoor National Park. The dark blue areas were the areas the consultation and review was proposing to ban camping in. And look at this map, the map of where camping is allowed now, following Dartmoor National Park's deal to pay landowners. It's identical. It can't be coincidence that the exact changes proposed in the consultation review to restrict camping area and rules are the exact same changes passed since Darwall's agreement with the DMPA. It makes you wonder, was it all a conspiracy all along? Did Darwall conspire with the DMPA to restrict camping rights and in the process siphon off an undisclosed amount of taxpayers' money? Or were the DMPA simply opportunists and took Darwall's court case as an opportunity to pass the bylaws that had been proposed and vehemently contested in the consultation review? Did the DMPA even intend to win the court case? Suddenly a cascade of questions come to mind. It's clear that Darwall's actions were a money grab, a chess move designed to funnel more cash into his pocket.
I'm unashamed, you know, we try to make money.
And a pretty ballsy one at that. The question is, what was the DMPA's involvement?
So that's the Dartmoor National Park Association Authority and Darwall. Absolutely amazing. I think the shocking thing about that is really that none of our mainstream press in London figured any of this out. But Ken Rawdon at Ker Bear Adventures has sussed it out. He went through the actual documents and say, oh, look at this. Isn't it funny? This agreement that the Dartmoor National Park have done with this evil landowner, well, this nasty landowner, this guy who wants to stop people camping on his land, which has been a time-worn tradition in Dartmoor. Well, it looks as if they've just cooked it up together. And they never intended potentially to win that court case. So well done, Ken. And I'll put a link up, obviously, to that full investigation there on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time now for our final item before the faith bit is Mark Purdy, where he talks this week about in the fourth of eight episodes of the Purdy interview, what are the symptoms of organophosphate poisoning? And this is an interview I did with Mark way back in 2000. He's since died, but he was an absolute pioneer in uncovering the ruthlessness of the Ministry of Agriculture, Fishery and Foods in actually poisoning the cows, and then those poisoned cows were fed to humans who were also poisoned in BSE and CJD.
When you're exposed to the chemical, your nerves go into overdrive. Too much of the nerve chemical messenger is secreted across synapses, which are the gaps between the nerves, so that you go into overdrive. You start salivating a lot, you start sweating, you get a tremor, you get neuralgic type shooting pains in your hands, a kind of numbness in the ends of the fingers, intestinal problems, your guts starts moving flat out, severe diarrhea. And then it moves more into central nervous problems, where you might become paranoid or extremely aggressive. So the symptoms are really very wide-ranging, ranging from wherever the nervous system supplies, whether it's the psychiatric centres, whether it's the glands, whether it's the digestive tract, even the heart. The heart has been known to go into irregular beats, and some farmers have had heart attacks after exposure to these chemicals. Other farmers have had problems with breathing. The breathing goes into, and some people have died as a result of the diaphragm paralyzing and the breathing stopping, because it hits right at the center of the central nervous system, the brainstem. It hits the peripheral nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. So you can see there's not much left that organophosphates don't touch in the human body.
So that's Mark Purdy there. The full video is up on YouTube and up on BitChute. If you'd like to peruse that, a fascinating farmer, organic farmer, that nobody really was listening to, very few people at the time, although he did also do a book about it, really exposed organophosphates and the ICI chemical called Phosmet, which was being used to treat cows as the real cause of BSC and also CJD. So final item this week is with David Livingstone. I spoke to him this week, and I'll obviously put the full version of the interview, which is over an hour altogether, because Alexander Dugin, who Livingstone thinks is quite a significant figure, has been speaking out, talking about the Nazis in Ukraine. His daughter was killed a couple of months ago in a bomb attack. But David Livingstone thinks that also that this guy that I went to school with, Nick Land, is quite a significant figure in the whole accelerationist movement. So, well, let's have a listen to that clip from David Livingstone now, where he talks about the accelerationists.
Nick Land is considered the father of accelerationism, and this is how it all connects. So, what's interesting is that I mentioned that the Process Church is really the organization that is behind all of this, right? And you got to understand how the Process Church connects everything, right? So the Process Church links to the Manson killings, right? Because he was trying to accelerate the Entente as well. And
yeah, I don't want to interrupt you, David, but really, yeah. Manson seemed to be trying to start a race war. That's one of the, you know, purposes of what he was up to, you know, that, basically killing whites, pretending to be blacks, and vice versa.
Yes, to create chaos, right? As not just not a race war itself, but to create a race war to create chaos. Right. So if you to look at this network now, the Manson killings involved the wife of Roman Polanski, right? Who filmed Rosemary's Baby, whose advisor was Anton LaVey, founder of the Church of Satan, right? The producer of Rosemary's Baby was Robert Evans. And Robert Evans was friends with, what is his name? This is what Tamori Terry revealed, who was the recognized head of the Process Church. And interesting, Robert Evans is a very influential person in Hollywood. He basically produced, I think, Chinatown, the Cotton Club, I can't remember what else. He was married for a week to Catherine Oxenberg. She was the daughter. Anyway, too many tangents here. Catherine Oxenberg's daughter ended up being in Nexium. And Robert Evans was also friends with Henry Kissinger. Right? So again, that name pops up. So it's a side network basically that connects the Church of Satan. And so this is how you get back to people like James Mason, who was the founder of the Siege magazine, which is also influential in this Iron March forums. So what happened is that when the Process Church, in fact, there's a whole chapter I have to, you know, I'm just going to mention briefly where the Process Church comes from. Process Church was founded by two people. One of them was Marianne de Grimstone. And she was basically, she was a former wife of Sugar Ray Robinson, the boxer. But she was one of the girls that were working for Stephen Ward. And Stephen Ward is the one that used to operate a Masonic black magic sex parties at Cliveden House. And the Cliveden House is the location of the what's so-called Cliveden Set. And the Cliveden Set is just another name for the Round Table. It was a house that belonged to Lady Astor and her whole circle, and that's basically regrouped the network of collaborationists, British collaborationists during World War II. So Stephen Ward was also friends with William Hitchcock, who funded Timothy Leary's Millbrook experiments on Millbrook Estate.
Well, this was Christine Keeler and the Profumo affair, of course.
Most importantly, Christine Keeler of the Profumo affair. Right. So just to tell you how deep this goes. So the Process Church is not just this one fringe little cult that, you know, showed up in California and influenced Charles Manson. It's really at the core. When the Process Church disbanded, a lot of its members then went and started to hang around Gilles Deleuze. Gilles Deleuze, who's one of the leading figures in the postmodernist movement, connected with people like Derrida and Foucault and that whole network. Again, this is another network now, which is, I talk about them in my chapter called Make Love, Not War. I can't give you all the connections, but there's a lot of deep sort of subversive connections that they're involved in. And so this is to show you the broader connection of the Process Church. And so Land picked up on this idea, you know, this sort of postmodernist challenge to the capitalist system that he inherited from Deleuze, and that's what effectively influenced the modern accelerationist movement. And that accelerationist movement is, so not only is Nick Land has endorsed the Order of the Nine Angles, but the Order of the Nine Angles now is affiliated with this network of neo-fascist, neo-Nazi terrorist organizations who have adopted the accelerationist philosophy, which they interpret as carrying out acts of terror to foment chaos to accelerate the coming of the end times.
Well, pretty comprehensive look at Nick Land and his relationship there with the Charles Manson's Process Church, and also the fact that, you know, it goes so deep in this kind of transatlantic world. Another thing that David talks about in the talk there, that interview I did with him earlier this week, was, I find these things absolutely fascinating. I hope other people have got the understanding that these networks really do need to be uncovered, particularly the Order of the Nine Angles and these far-right terrorist networks. And what they're doing is they are basically out there to commit murders, secret murders, and also do things like infiltrate courts, infiltrate the police. That's also their job. And yet they keep almost, they've managed to keep themselves almost completely out of the headlines, haven't they? Have you heard anyone talking about, oh yes, we must watch out for the Order of the Nine Angles? We keep hearing about all these various Muslim things that we've got. In fact, there were people up on talk radio today, you know, they were saying, oh yeah, this is Muslims coming across in the channel. Look, this isn't about them. This is about the people who are actually creating the terror. And David knows all about that. And he's done, I think, an incredible forensic job, really, with a kind of map of who the networks are in the far right today. Amazing thing is, of course, that people like Nick Land and Yuval Noah Harari are the ideologues for many of the people like Bill Gates, etc., Elon Musk. They're the ones who are putting the words into their mouths so they don't have to think. They just copy what Yuval Noah Harari says. They read his book and they think that they know it all. They don't really think for themselves. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, who was John Langley, the who also stood for mayor of Bristol, as well as being a porn star. He's also now an author of a book called The Sexual Philanthropist, out this weekend. And also thanks, of course, again to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, and you can comment on there too. You can also subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. But please don't subscribe with a Google account. You might find that suddenly a few months ago your Google emails ran out because Google have decided that it's just spam I'm posting you. For whatever reason, and of course we know who runs Google, National Security Agency. It's their front end. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I've got paperbacks out, which you can get via bilderberg.org. You can get free versions or you can get printed out versions, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers, which looks at the secret links between the Winston Churchill's private secretary and Adolf Hitler's private secretary in the last year or so of the war, Second World War. And also the anthology From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here. And over on Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioqk.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the auto ab KO, that's David Livingstone's latest book, Banksters, get you down.